Good morning, members. I'm going to call the committee meeting to order. We slowed down a bit this morning just because of the snow and the difficulty for perhaps those who live in the metro area more than those who live in greater Minnesota. Just for the getting here was not the easiest this morning. We have an extremely busy day today. We're going to have two things, and I just want to outline it right away. We are starting with the triclosan. I understand. I didn't see the paper this morning. I just kicked the paper aside when I walked out the door, but I understand there's an article in the Star Tribune. We are having it Xeroxed for you, and it or copied for you, and it will be distributed in a few minutes. So we are going to be talking about the triclosan issue and the science done by the University of Minnesota. And so we'll start with that. We're going to have the Minnesota Department of Health. We're going to have somebody from the Friends of Mississippi. We're going to talk about the Clean Water Fund, but I understand somebody is here from the American Chemist Cleaning Institute who has a flight out this afternoon and would like a few minutes. So we will try to put that in the agenda depending on how many questions are asked. And then tonight, you know, we have public testimony. And one of the things we had talked about much earlier in the session is we have had lots of discussions about groundwater. There have been some articles in a large article in the Star Tribune and a report by NPR in addition talking about groundwater and what's happening in Minnesota. At the beginning of the year, I said that we would ask those who use groundwater to do some problem solving, and they have been invited tonight. We don't have a list here for you yet, but we will have that of people who signed up. We have invited everyone who would like to talk, and that's what we will do this evening. So this morning is testimony. This evening is problem solving. And with that, I welcome Dr. William Arnold and Dr. Daniel Engstrom. Welcome to the committee. If you just put your name on the record.
Sure. I'm William Arnold. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. Well, thank you, Chairman Wiggini.
And I'm Dan Engstrom. I direct the St. Croix Watershed Research Station for the Science Museum of Minnesota, and I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota in Earth Sciences.
And our colleague, Tim LaPera, just walked in, and he'll probably join us here momentarily. So we were asked to present this morning the results of a study that we did on triclosan and its degradation products in Minnesota lakes. The study was largely funded by the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund, as recommended by the Legislative Citizens Committee on Minnesota Resources. And because this was a study funded by state dollars, we felt it was important that we didn't just publish it in the scientific journal, which the document identifier is given here, but also that the citizens and stakeholders knew what we had found. Now, I want to start off by acknowledging that chemicals are incredibly useful, and I'm certainly not chemophobic. I'm certain I will need some caffeine later today after the long drive in and the ibuprofen from shoveling the snow this morning. And, you know, there's always this kind of risk, the trade-off between benefit and risk. And so, for example, in the summertime, my children, I definitely put sunscreen on them, right, because I feel whatever small risk there is from exposure to the sunscreen agent is far outweighed by the long-term risks of skin cancer. Similarly with insect repellents. I would much rather not get bitten, and, you know, there are disease vectors there as well, and take those trade-offs. But we need to make sure we're using chemicals responsibly. So triclosan is used in a wide array of consumer products, ranging from liquid hand soaps, toothpastes, dish soaps for washing dishes in your sink, acne creams, deodorants, and it's also infused into various products under the trade name Microban, in plastic products, so you can get it in cutting boards and dish racks and all sorts of other things like that. It was originally patented in about 1964 and then introduced first into healthcare industry products in the 70s and really made its way into consumer products in the 80s. So current production, about 300 metric tons a year in the U.S., about the same in Europe as well. So if you go into the store today and look at a liquid hand soap, a recent survey found that 76% of the liquid hand soaps contain triclosan, and about 20% of the bar soaps do. And the amount in there varies depending on the specific product, but anywhere from 0.1 to 1% of the volume in there. Now, because soaps and toothpaste and dish soaps and the like are used with washing like that, so the triclosan is used, a large fraction of it winds up going down the drain. So when it goes to the drain, it eventually winds up in the wastewater treatment plant. And our wastewater treatment plants actually do a very good job at moving a large portion of the triclosan. Depending on the study, and there are various ones out there in the literature, 90 to 95% of the triclosan is removed. And then there are various ratios reported as to how much of that is biodegradation in the activated sludge tank and how much of that is sticking onto the biosolids or the sludge. We've done a study, and I'll show some of that data momentarily, that shows that it is incomplete removal in the liquid phase, and some of it is discharged into surface water. So if your wastewater treatment plant is discharging into a river, that effluent carries triclosan with it into the river, and if you're discharging into a lake, the wastewater effluent carries that into the lake. So that's one route where triclosan can enter the environment. The other is from the biosolids that are produced during wastewater treatment. They have triclosan absorbed onto them, and a fraction of that in Minnesota, something about 30% or so of biosolids are applied onto the land as fertilizer. So that's another way that triclosan is reintroduced to the environment. Now, some of it may stay in the soil. There's the potential for it to run off when it rains. And there's one research group at Michigan State has shown that specific crops can take up triclosan from the soil. But that is not our work. So how much triclosan is in waters in Minnesota? So we did a study a couple of years ago looking just at the Metro Wastewater Treatment Plant. We were trying to figure out what happened to triclosan during the disinfection process. And we found that the effluent from the Metro Wastewater Treatment Plant is between 100 and 200 nanograms per liter of triclosan. There was a larger study by the USGS published in 2002 where they looked at 139 streams across the U.S., and they found that their median concentration of triclosan they found in the surface waters they analyzed was 140 nanograms per liter. The highest they saw was 2.3 micrograms per liter, or 2,300 nanograms per liter. They analyzed a couple of sites in Minnesota in this study and saw between 50 and 110 nanograms per liter of triclosan in the water. Now, there have been a slew of toxicology studies, and I am not a toxicologist, so this is me cleaning data from the EPA database. And it seems that the most sensitive species to triclosan out there are algae, and the lowest reported concentrations where there's some kind of effect or no observed effect or low observed effect level would be about 15 nanograms per liter, but it ranges by orders of magnitude higher depending on the algal species, depending on the fish, depending on what animal is tested. There is also evidence of bioaccumulation of triclosan. So, for example, algae, the reported bioaccumulation factor is about 1,000, meaning that if the concentration in the algae in the river would be about 1,000 times greater than that in the water. And also there's evidence that fish take up triclosan as well. So our particular interest was looking at what happened to triclosan after it was discharged. And we were interested not only in triclosan, but three compounds that we call chlorinated triclosan derivatives. And these form when triclosan is exposed to chlorine during disinfection. So the last step in the wastewater treatment process at many plants, in Minnesota only seasonally, really in April through October, there's a chlorine disinfection step. And so what that does is adds chlorine atoms to the triclosan molecule, so we wind up with chemicals that are essentially structurally identical to triclosan with one or two more chlorines added onto the ring. And we had done previous laboratory work that showed when you expose triclosan and these chlorinated triclosan derivatives to sunlight, in somewhere between 0.5% yield to 3% yield, you get very specific dioxin congeners. And there are 209 different dioxins. And so there are four specific ones that we could link to triclosan. Now, we wanted to look at the sediments in these lake and river systems because sediments serve as integrators of pollution. The solubility of triclosan is relatively low, 1 to 10 milligrams per liter, depending on the pH. The dioxins are extremely low solubility, on the order of micrograms per liter, which means they really don't like being in water and they'll associate with particles. And of course, particles slowly settle out and wind up in the bottoms of lakes and rivers. And because there's this continuous source and there are ways to figure out when the sediment is deposited, we can date the sediment as a function of depth and look at the chemicals that have been deposited over a function of time. And that may give us some idea as to what exposure of the system was over time as well. So we looked at eight different lakes around the state, two here near the metro area, Lake Pepin and Lake St. Croix, two out a little bit west, northwest of here in Lake Winona and East Lake Gemini, and then four in the northern part of the state, Lake Chagawa, which gets the wastewater from Ely. Little Lake Wilson was our reference lake. It doesn't have any wastewater input. Duluth Harbor, which isn't quite a lake, but it has two wastewater inputs from Superior and Duluth there. And then we went out on a research cruise about 9 miles offshore and took a core out of, or a set of cores out of Lake Superior as well. So I don't want to get real deep into the science of what was done, but Dan Engstrom here did all the dating and can address any questions about that issue. So basically three different techniques, looking at the lead isotopes, the cesium-137 from the atomic testing, which peaked in the mid-60s, and also looking at the magnetic profiles. We can figure out approximately what year different layers of sediment were deposited. To look for the chemicals at the University of Minnesota, we did the chlorinated triclosan derivatives and triclosan by doing a solvent extraction of the sediment and then using a tandem mass spectrometer to quantify how much was there and put some internal standards in to make sure everything was accounted for correctly. And then we collaborated with Pace Analytical Services in Minneapolis to do the dioxin analysis because they're EPA certified for that and do it routinely. And it was easier to have them do it than us. So to start off, we started with looking at Lake St. Croix and Lake Pepin. And the reason we chose these two lakes is they have relatively large watersheds. And so they integrate large amounts of runoff throughout the state. So for example, if you take Lake Pepin, it overall integrates about half of to two-thirds of the water, depending whether you count Lake St. Croix's watershed as well. So we get a large signal of what's kind of happening across the entire state. And then, of course, Lake Pepin is a broadening in the river, so there's lots of sediment deposition there. And so it's a place where we thought chemicals might accumulate. So we've actually looked at Lake Pepin a couple of different times. This is the more recent data. Lake Pepin, of course, integrates all the wastewater from the Twin Cities as well, where the majority of the population of the state lives. And we see that there was essentially no triclosan before about 1960 in the sediment. And then there was an increase in concentration that, as it was introduced into hospital consumer products in the 70s and 80s. We reported in our research article actually accumulation rates in nanograms per centimeter squared per year, but that's kind of hard to wrap one's brain around. So ever given the concentrations we find in nanograms per gram of triclosan here, and it winds up being about 10 nanograms per gram in recent sediments. The chlorinated triclosan derivatives are lower, and this makes sense because we see much lower concentrations of the chlorinated triclosan derivatives coming out of wastewater treatment plants, and so the ratio is approximately what we would expect based on what's coming out of the wastewater treatment plants, but they're also increasing as a function of time. One thing to note with the dating here is that there is some uncertainty in the dating. So, you know, triclosan wasn't invented until 1964, but we see it slightly before that. This isn't unusual in sediment dating. There's some error in the dating of plus or minus 5 years. The sediments are biologically active, and so the worms and other things in there can mix the sediment up and take sediment that was deposited recently and mix it downward a little bit. And also over at long time scales, you can even have chemical diffusion that might send chemicals in down gradient into the sediment. If we look at the four dioxins that come from triclosan, we see similar trends in their profiles. So the 2,8-dichlorodibenzodioxin really didn't exist before 1960 in the sediment core, and then when triclosan came into the system, its concentration increased, which indicates to us that triclosan is a potential source of this dioxin, because we know triclosan, when it's photolyzed, forms this dioxin, and they tend to co-correlate. Similarly, the two trichlorinated dioxins and the tetrachlorinated dioxin that come from the 3-chlorinated triclosan derivatives, their trends follow quite similarly the trends of the total sum of the chlorinated triclosan derivatives that are being deposited in the sediments. Lake St. Croix is a somewhat smaller watershed and obviously integrates fewer sources. So the concentrations are somewhat lower in the sediment. You know, the most recent sediments are about 6 nanograms per gram. But we do see, again, the increasing trend in the dioxins that are coming from triclosan and chlorinated triclosan derivatives. One interesting feature in the chlorinated triclosan derivative profile is this increase followed by the sharp decrease. What we believe that is that the St. Croix Valley Wastewater Treatment Plant in 1993 switched from chlorine disinfecting their effluent with chlorine to UV, or ultraviolet light. And so if they make that switch, there's no chlorine being introduced, the chlorinated triclosan derivatives would not be produced in that last treatment step, which potentially lead to lower levels being formed. Now, we don't see the similar pattern in the dioxins that are derived from the chlorinated triclosan derivatives. Those are relatively low levels, and so we may just be able to pick it up. Also, there is another source of wastewater to the system from Hudson that still uses is chlorine. So if we go out to East Lake Gemini, which I'm not going to show you the data for, it's an artificial impoundment, as well as Lake Winona. The reason we chose these two lakes is they're relatively small lakes that have a high fraction of their inflow being wastewater. I think East Lake Gemini was actually created to take the wastewater from St. Ben and St. John's, and Lake Winona gets the wastewater from Alexandria. So it turns out 63%, according to the MPCA, of the inflow from Lake Winona comes from the Alexandria Wastewater Treatment Plant. And so the concentrations that we see in the sediments here are significantly higher than they are in Lake Pepin, where you have much more water and dilution of that signal. So the concentrations peak out at about 175 nanograms per gram and are decreasing. In terms of the flux to the sediments, if we look at the accumulation rates, they actually haven't changed that much over time, so probably the solids that are depositing have lowered as well, or increased. Think about that for a moment. Increased. Got that backwards. We see, again, compared to the Lake St. Croix or Lake Pepin, high concentrations of the chlorinated triclosan derivatives, so 1 to 2 nanograms per liter, or thousands of picograms per liter. So in this lake, the chlorinated triclosan derivatives concentrations are on the order of the triclosan concentrations in the larger lakes that have much larger watersheds. And again, we see strong accumulation and increase in concentration of the four dioxins that are derived from the photochemical degradation of triclosan. And here again, the 2,8-dichlorodibenzodioxin, its concentration is about 6 nanograms per liter in the most recent sediments. And that's comparable to the triclosan concentration, actually, in Lake Pepin. So this is a lake that's got, it's relatively shallow. It's got about a third of the lake is a photic zone. So there's enough time here for the triclosan to be exposed to sunlight and for these reactions to occur and the dioxins to accumulate. We then went up and looked at four northern Minnesota lakes to look for to get a spread across the state, across the state, excuse me, and also to include Little Lake Wilson, which has no anthropogenic input of wastewater. So Lake Duluth Harbor looks somewhat similar to Lake Pepin or Lake St. Croix. The more interesting one, in my opinion here, is Lake Superior. So this is about 9 miles out from Duluth Harbor in a definitional zone. And here it's obviously an area where you've got a lot of dilution and it takes a lot of time for the sediment to potentially get out there. But we do see a triclosan signal out in Lake Superior up to about 1 nanogram per gram in the most recent sediments. We do see the dioxins that are derived from triclosan here, but interestingly enough, we see them all the way down the core, which suggests to us there is another source of these four dioxins that is not triclosan. The concentrations do bump up once triclosan is introduced, so like post-1975 in the Lake Superior sediment, the concentrations are higher due to the contribution of triclosan. But there is a secondary source of these dioxins. What that is, let's go to the next one here. So if we go to Lake Little Wilson on the next slide, here we don't see any triclosan or chlorinated triclosan derivatives in the sediment, which makes sense because there's no wastewater coming into this lake. We do, again, see trace levels of these four dioxins, which means there is a background source. And we don't know if this is region-specific to northern Minnesota or if it's also occurs further south, but the deposition rates in the lakes are higher and the signal is being washed out. But some potential possibilities where this is coming from are municipal incinerators, paper mills, forest fires, metal smelting, are all known sources of dioxins. And most previous work looking at dioxins has only looked at dioxins that have four chlorines and above. And so these could have always been there and just not been looked for. What's clear, though, is that in the wastewater-impacted lakes is that once triclosan was introduced, these four dioxins predominantly come from triclosan and not some other source. So if we look at the total mass of dioxins in these systems, and I will readily admit that mass and toxicity are not equivalent with dioxins, the total mass of dioxin being input into these lakes varies that we can attribute to triclosan varies from, 2 or 3% in the best case in older sediments to 50 or 60% in East Lake Gemini and Lake Winona, where you have a system dominated by wastewater. And like Pepin, it maxes out around 30%. Now, the question I always get asked is what about the toxicity of these dioxins? And interestingly enough, there is not a whole lot of data about the toxicity of these dioxins, and we looked really hard. Most of the data out there was from the 80s, and of course, toxicity tests and all sorts of other things have changed since then. There is one recent study, which is the best one we found to date, using some newer assays, that suggests that the worst case scenario, these dioxins that are derived from triclosan are at most 1,000 times less toxic than the most toxic dioxin congeners. And it could be as much as 10,000 times less toxic. That said, we looked for all the different dioxins in these lake sediments, and we don't see the most toxic congener, which is 2,3,7,8 tetrachlorobenzodioxin. It's not there, and so it's not driving the toxicity. It's other dioxins that are. And so we could make some hand-waving estimation as to what the toxicity is, but we're not particularly comfortable with that, not being toxicologists. One interesting trend that we found, and this is some of our older data from Lake Pepin, is if we look just by chlorination level of the dioxins, so there can be between 2 and 8 chlorines on dioxins. The more higher chlorinated dioxins tend to come from incineration sources. And so in the 70s, we recognized that incinerators were a major source of dioxins, and new controls were put onto incinerators, changed the operating conditions to lower this amount. And we can see the OCCD is octa, HPCDD is 7 chlorines, and HX is 6 chlorines. Those have been largely decreasing since the 1970s as we've changed our incineration practices. The congeners that come from triclosan, the dichlorinated and the trichlorinated, have been increasing since that same time period when triclosan was introduced. And so that's why the contribution of these triclosan-derived dioxins, as we call them, has been increasing in the lakes over time. Of the tetrachlorinated dioxins, only a portion of that is attributed to triclosan because there are many tetrachlorinated congeners. Interestingly enough, in our studies, the 2,8 dichlorobenzodioxin is the only dichlorinated dioxin that we see. And so that would suggest that all of that particular congener is coming from triclosan. Now, we could be missing, depending on our acquisition windows and our mass spec, we could be missing some of those congeners, but we don't think that's the case. So this isn't our work, but it's from Ralph Halton at Arizona State. And so I said before that another route that the triclosan is removed is in the biosolids. And so Professor Halden has done work. He has the biosolids library from the EPA, from wastewater treatment plants across the country. And they tend to find about 15 milligrams of triclosan per kilogram in the biosolids. So that's much higher concentrations than we see in water samples. But this isn't surprising because triclosan doesn't like to be in water. And so it partitions it into the biosolids. So, you know, when there's the land application, there's potential to affect bacteria in the soil. There, I already mentioned there's the potential for it to be uptaken by certain crops. Professor Halden also suggested that we ought to be looking at whether or not we incinerate these biosolids if we get those same dioxin formation reactions. No one has looked at that yet, but it's something that's worthy of study. The most interesting part of his study that I find is that he looked at the total mass of all the pharmaceuticals and personal care products that are in these biosolids and found that approximately two-thirds of the mass could be attributed to two chemicals, and that was triclosan and another antimicrobial that's largely used in bar soaps, which is triclocarban. And then the next major category was antibiotics. But, I mean, so a large fraction of the total mass, and again, mass is not equivalent to biological activity or toxicity or anything else like that. But a large portion of the mass that's in the biosolids is coming from these two chemicals alone. Now, these other things are things that we're not experts in specifically, but that being informed scientists give us pause. Right, and so triclosan, when you use it on your hands or on your underarms or things like that, it's not just used, doesn't stay on the surface of your skin to have the action it's supposed to have there. It diffuses through your skin, and so the CDC has detected triclosan in the urine of 75% of the people that they test, and so we are exposing ourselves internally to this compound as well as externally. There was a Swedish study that showed that it was in the blood plasma and the milk of nursing mothers. Right? So again, that just talks to the fact that it doesn't stay on the surface of your skin. Now, these other studies are more recent. So there was a recent study that suggests that at potentially relevant human exposure levels, it impairs muscle function in mice and impairs swimming behavior in fish at high concentrations. Now, not being a toxicologist, but I do know it enough to say this. It's hard to extrapolate from high doses to low doses. It's hard to go from animal models to humans. These are all huge extrapolations, and we don't do human testing. But just the fact that these articles keep coming out where they find some biological effect is something we should consider. The other thing that's talked about a lot is the potential for resistance. And it's clear at this point that the use of triclosan is not the cause of all the... Tim will yell at me if I say this. The use of antibiotics versus antibacterials is causing the resistance issues we have in hospital settings and the like. One of the worries, though, is that when a bacteria strain or whatever is resistant to one antibiotic, it often is resistant to multiple antibiotic or antibacterial compounds. And so if you've got things that have resistance, they could have multi-resistance as well. You can. Good enough? Okay. So the FDA, if you look at their website, says that it's not effective. It does not have any evidence that triclosan has any benefit over washing with regular soap and water. And some other recent things that have come out are that Johnson & Johnson is planning to phase it out of their products by 2015. And that it was recently reported as well that Kaiser Permanente, which is a large hospital group in California, doesn't allow it in their facilities. And so... In conclusion, what our study shows is that triclosan, its chlorinated derivatives, and its dioxin photoproducts are being deposited into Minnesota lakes. It's our opinion that there's questionable benefit of using triclosan, at least according to the FDA website. There is some evidence that there may be environmental or health concerns here. These aren't conclusive at this point, and they aren't my area of expertise, so I leave those to others. The other thing we know is that if we wanted to engineer a solution to get triclosan out of the wastewater stream, we could do it. It would be expensive. We could put in ozonators, and it would certainly destroy triclosan. We know that's been shown that works. It would be costly. It would be high carbon footprint as well. And so it would potentially be much less expensive to curtail its use than it would be to upgrade the wastewater facilities to take the compound out. Anything I missed?
Perfect.
We have time for questions, and we welcome Dr. LaPara here, too, if you could want to pull up a seat. Members, questions?
I
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there's a lot of information to try and digest in a short time. And I have a number of questions. I'm not going to ask them all. First, you know, we hear the term dioxins, and it kind of puts this fear factor into the conversation. But my understanding is that there's, and you've expressed that, there are a number of different dioxins out there. Can you give us a little bit better definition of which dioxins are a result of the breakdown of this chemical and how dangerous those dioxins are?
Sure. Chairman Wiggins, members of the committee, there are four specific dioxins that come from triclosan, and I will try and remember what they are off the top of my head, because there's lots of different numbers. There's one dichlorinated dioxin that comes from triclosan, 2,8-dichlorid of benzodioxin. There are two trichlorinated ones that come from the chlorinated triclosan derivatives, which are 2,3,7-trichlorid of benzodioxin and 1,2,8-trichlorid of benzodioxin. And there's one tetrachlorinated dioxin, which I think is 1,2,3,8 or 1,2,7,8. It's certainly somewhere in the presentation it was there, but I have to, you'd think I'd have it memorized after all this time. But so in terms of toxicity, the most toxic dioxin is 2,3,7,8, and that's the one that was a big concern for 30 years. And that one is, you know, anywhere from 1 to 10,000 times more toxic than the ones that we're finding here. But that one is also at much lower concentrations than what we find here as well. And so each specific kind of chlorination level and sometimes even specific chlorine positions have toxicity. But those are only really reported for dioxins that have four chlorines and up, because those were the ones derived from incineration. And so the ones with two or three chlorines have received much less attention until very recently. I think the new data on that is only just starting to come out.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So how many dioxins are out there? You mentioned, I think, half a dozen.
There are 209 different congeners of dioxins, and depending on what the sources are and what the formation pathways are, the specific amounts of all those 209 can vary widely. And I'm not an expert in the incineration of dioxin or dioxin formation from incineration. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the other thing I noticed in your presentation is that the scales jump around a lot. I mean, you make the graphs all look similar, but when you look at the scale or the numbers at the bottom, they vary dramatically, and so it's really hard for us non-scientists to try and compare apples to apples here when the scale is jumping all over the place. And, you know, how minute are these concentrations?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, both excellent questions. The reason the scales are done that way is because we pulled these from the publication, and you want to make sure that you can see what's going on, and I admit that's a limitation here. So the way to talk about this is basically the large lakes versus the small lakes. So Lake Pepin and Lake St. Croix, that scale goes from about 0 to 20, maybe 30. And in the smaller lakes, so East Lake Gemini and Lake Winona, for example, it goes from maybe 0 to 200. So there's a factor of 10 difference in those scales. And that has to do with the lake system scale, how big the watershed is, how much water is flowing through the lake, and how directly impacted it is by wastewater. And how big are these concentrations? That's also an excellent question. And it's hard to make fair comparisons in some ways. These concentrations are comparable in some places to other chemicals were of concern. So I was looking through a USGS study recently that said, you know, and this is not a fair comparison in terms of potential impact. Right, that some PCB concentrations in some of Minnesota water systems are comparable to what we see, for example, with triclosan. That said, PCBs are a totally different ball of wax in terms of their bioaccumulation and their toxicity. So I just want to give the phrase that these, you know, in terms of nanograms per gram, we're talking, you know, billionths with a B there in terms of the total mass of the sediment. But small concentrations can have potential impacts due to biological accumulation of them, and depending on what their biological activity is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One final question. How quickly do these products degrade in the environment, not only the triclosan, but the dioxins you're talking about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's something we have not specifically studied. We do know that, for example, if the dioxins stay in the water column, they will slowly photodegrade, but they're so hydrophobic they tend to stick in the sediment. And there are biological processes that can degrade them in the sediment. Again, I think Professor Halden at Arizona State has shown some evidence, actually in some Minnesota samples he took, that he sees some biological degradation products of triclosan and of triclocarban in the sediments. Now, I didn't do that work, so I don't know all the details. But we've been inputting the chemical for 50 years or so, and we're seeing it that signal there, so it's probably relatively slow. Now, if we stop inputting it, will the levels go down over time? I'm sure they would. The sediments are good at slowly processing contaminants over time, but chlorinated compounds tend to be persistent, and it takes longer for them to degrade than some other compounds.
I'm sorry, I have one more question, Madam Chair. Do these compounds migrate from the sediment back into the water column?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is, I will say yes with some caveats. Certainly, that if there are gradients in chemical concentration, you can have, if there's an equilibrium there. And if that equilibrium is disrupted in some way, so the concentration in the water drops, there's a potential for compounds to diffuse back out. If there are storm events or other things that mix up the sediment, and the sediment's disturbed, they'll go back into the water column, and then stuff can diffuse off of the sediment. But if you bury things, then there is a point where they can't come back up, depending on how deep they're buried.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about the testing, and from the documentation here, it's clear that you found that there's a bioaccumulation in the aquatic food chain and impact on the heart muscle of mice and fish, and or that you have peer reviewed that literature anyway. And my question is, so it's in the bottom of the lakes, and is it in the, have studies been done on the sludge that's taken from our waste stream and then put back on our farmland, and what do we know? I don't know if you've done any of that or if you know any others that have done that, and what impact that might have on the cropland.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that is an area that's just starting to be explored. I think there have been studies that show that the biosolids that are put onto cropland can contain triclosan. There is one group at Michigan State that has looked at very specific crops to figure out and shown that, you know, some specific vegetables do take up triclosan. I don't remember what they are off the top of my head, and I don't know how broadly produced those particular crops are. And any other issues in that? But I don't think there's also the potential with when there's, I know, and this study was several years ago, there was one study that showed that when there's wastewater irrigation or sludge applied to farm fields, when it rains, you can detect some pharmaceuticals in that runoff. I don't remember if triclosan was one of those that was specifically studied in those situations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that something you could check out and get back to us on?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we can do anything for money, right? So, the analyses are rather expensive and time-consuming. So.
Actually, Madam Chair, I just meant if you could let us know what the studies are that you. But I didn't mean for you.
Oh, if you want to do a lit review, we can certainly do that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Erickson's next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's that increasing. There's something about the fish that they're starting to swim slower or whatever it was. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, members of the committee. This was a recent study where they put triclosan into a fish tank, essentially with the fish, and looked at their response to the triclosan and showed that it did affect their fish swimming behavior. That said, the levels that they used were much higher than anything that's seen in the environment. But it's just one piece of evidence that says that, you know, there are potentially unanticipated biological effects of this compound. And it's something that needs further study, and that's beyond my expertise to do those sorts of studies.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'm not sure whether Dr. Arnold or his colleagues would want to answer this, but I'm just curious in having a discussion with a representative of the companies that are using triclosan. There was a discussion about toothpaste and that having this chemical in toothpaste helps with preventing certain mouth diseases like gingivitis and so. Mm-hmm. And but I noticed that Colgate Palmolive is replacing triclosan with lactic acid. I'm just wondering whether the professors have any knowledge about the usefulness of this product in toothpaste, or whether or not lactic acid has any environmental problems similar to triclosan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Would you put your name on the record?
I'm Tim LaPera from the University of Minnesota. In the reading that I have done, triclosan in toothpaste is marketed as an anti-gingivitis. It essentially will inhibit bacteria from growing on your gums, which will cause gingivitis. And so that is one of the few benefits that I've seen documented well, and it's convincing to me, for the use of triclosan. There are certainly alternatives that you could have the similar effect. Various mouthwashes also started marketing themselves as anti-gingivitis. As far as specifically lactic acid, I'm not actually aware of that specific effect. So I would prefer not to comment.
We will have the health department coming up.
Good. That's why I preface my question.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Benson.
Do the professors, do any of you see any, or have, from what you've studied, have you seen any studies that indicate that triclosan in hand washes has any effect other than as a marketing strategy?
Representative, Madam Chair, Representative, members of the committee, I rely on what the FDA and the and Minnesota Department of Health tell me on that, and that's what they state, that it's regular soap and water is just as effective as that with triclosan, but we haven't studied that specifically.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the one of your earlier slides, it talked about water testing or sediment testing done nationally and also in Minnesota. And if I read that correctly, was Minnesota actually below the national average in terms of what that testing showed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so that's a difficult question to answer. So that was the USGS studied 139 different streams, two sites were in Minnesota. And the two sites that they tested in Minnesota, the concentrations were less than the median concentration, but there are various factors in there. And so if they had tested, for example, Lake Winona that was getting direct wastewater effluent, I would expect they would get a higher number. I think that the two sites they tested were along the Mississippi, south of the Twin Cities, and so there would be substantial dilution there. And so, you know, the highest concentration they saw, my guess would have been very shortly downstream of a wastewater treatment plant. And so I think saying what's average in Minnesota, we'd have to look at a broader statewide testing to figure out what that is.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Just to comment, the handout we received, you know, like 11 or 12 pages filled with a lot of scientific-looking whatever, formulas, whatever. But one of your four conclusions, to me, is rather subjective, saying that the use of triclosan is of questionable benefit. So, Madam Chair, I would hope that before this committee ends, we could hear from the Cleaning Institute folks before they have to leave to get some balance to the testimony this morning.
I think we are going to have that time, and we are also going to have time this evening. I understand there are a number of other people would like to testify. So we will do that. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Arnold to follow up on Representative Erickson's question about the fish and so forth with the concentrations, you said that the concentrations used in the study were much higher than what are occurring in Minnesota waters. What are those levels? Can you tell me what the levels are that they are using to generate those reactions from the fish?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that specific concentration is on the side of something like 15,000 nanograms per liter, whereas what we see in Minnesota waters are in the hundreds of nanograms per liter. There have been other studies that have used lower levels of triclosan. This was just one of the most recent ones out there. And again, this is an area of the literature I don't do research in, and so I don't have my finger on all of the studies that are out there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up for the members of the committee, I heard you say, and I was doing some math here myself, a nanogram is 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram. That's okay. And in a liter, if I remember my science from back in the day, there's 1,000 grams in a liter. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members, that's correct.
I'm 2 for 2. Thank you, Madam Chair. So then I'm going to take that one step further. Are there 1 trillion nanograms in 1 liter?
That is correct.
Thank you. I'm just doing some math here, folks, so we can figure these things out. And then you said on the slide with regards on page 3 on your presentation that there's between 100 and 200 nanograms per liter, and that was in the metro water. Is that correct? I just want to...
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Thank you. So, thank you, Madam Chair. So we're talking about 1 or 2 parts per trillion. Currently,
Madam Chair, it's be hundreds of parts per trillion.
Yep, 1 or 200. Yep.
Yes.
Okay, I stand corrected. Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. I should have a whiteboard and a marker right now. Back in the classroom, on page 2 of your handout, you said that 96% of products containing these are washed down the drain. Can you expand on that for me, please, a little bit? I think it's somewhat misleading in that you say just above that there's 300 metric tons per year used in the U.S. That would mean that there's like 288 metric tons of triclosan washed down the drain every year. So I just need some clarification on that, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, that's a point that's worth clarification. So of the products such as the hand soaps or the toothpaste and the like, those would be washed down the drain. Things that are plastic infused would probably not be washed down the drain at the same extent because they'll stay in the plastic for a period of time that's longer. And so, but soaps, dishwashing liquids, and the like, the large fraction of those will wind up going down the drain.
Okay.
In terms of the total mass of that 300 tons in the U.S. that goes down the drain, I'd have to do a broader survey of wastewater influence to see that. We've done an estimation of and I don't remember the number off the top of my head, one of our older studies and Professor Halden's studies, we've done estimations of the total amount that winds up in the environment, and it's on the order of, I can't remember, my recollection is 1 to 2,000 tons of that 300 winds up in the environment eventually, but I'd have to go back and look to double check.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on page 8 of your handout, it's the Lake Wilson slide, and you're measuring, I'm not exactly sure, I'm sorry, but on the slide you're showing different levels in Wilson Lake. It would be the left-hand graph. And it goes back to roughly 1870. I'm curious to know who or how were those measurements being taken back then. How do you get that data?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's my area of work, and that sediment core at about 1880 or whatever would have been about, I'm guessing about 30 centimeters down, about a foot or so in the sediment. That's a very easy thing to take a core. We slice those cores up. We analyzed these radioisotopes, particularly lead-210, cesium-137, and they allow us to date the cores back to perhaps as much as 200 years. Depends on the system. So they're lead-210 is a naturally occurring radioisotope. It's formed from radon-222, which is the stuff you worry about in your basement. And it travels in the atmosphere, decays away to lead-210, which then falls out in rainfall. The lead-210 then is scavenged by sediment particles, goes to the bottom, decays away with a half-life of 22 years. And we can then, knowing that rate of decay, applying various models of sediment accumulation, we can date the course in that fashion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm sorry I asked that last question.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to pick up the discussion of the level of exposure that I think Representative Fabian was talking about and just maybe ask a question. I know you earlier said that you're not a toxicologist, and so perhaps this will be a question that can come up with the health department, but anyway, I'd like you to take a stab at it. So I think we came up with the idea that there's 1 to 200 parts per trillion. I think that's what you arrived at. Can you explain the difference between threshold of dosage and timing of dosage? And the reason I'm asking you that is I think we know that some very teeny tiny amounts of exposure to various toxic substances impacts living bodies, not so much based on the actual threshold, but on the timing, the developmental stage of that organism. So babies, little children, pregnant women, the impact of, for example, you have human breast milk here, containing, I think it was a Swedish study, containing this product. Can you just comment on that? And if you can't, that's fine. But I'm just wondering if in your studies you've looked at the timing issue as differentiated from the actual threshold dosage level.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, members of the committee, no, I'm not comfortable answering that question. That's well beyond. I don't disagree that there's emerging scientific evidence that when doses are given of chemicals within life stages, that's important. I would not comment on that issue with triclosan at all. We haven't done any other studies. That would be for our colleagues in public health or epidemiology to comment on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe that's something we can get information on from those sources.
We really appreciate your work for Minnesotans. I am particularly interested in the bioaccumulation in fish because we have other things that are bioaccumulating in fish and slowing them down and making them vulnerable. So as we look at this work combined, perhaps we will have Dr. Schoenfuss from St. Cloud State visit with us too, because this is cumulative and really important and good work that you've done. And we really thank you, and thank you for coming in the snowstorm to share with us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. Next, we're going to have the Minnesota Department of Health. Senator Bremer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, members of the committee. I'm Linda Bremer. I'm Director of Environmental Health from the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm here to take a little different tact on triclosan. I don't have specific information on triclosan, but I'm going to talk about just antibacterial soaps in general. As you may be aware, hand washing is the single most important means of preventing the spread of infection. In the Environmental Health Division, I oversee the food safety restaurant inspectors, and it's a constant challenge to make sure people wash their hands. The American Society of Microbiology, in one study, only 75% of female adults and 58% of male adults wash their hands after using the bathroom. This is public health. I hear giggles. This is what we work with all the time. We did a study on the state fairgrounds one time, not during the state fair, but during a special event. And only 65% of the females and 40% of the males wash their hands after using the bathroom. So it's risk communication here. It's what's important. Some of you might have come to our booth at the state fair. We teach people how to wash hands at Germ City, and we use glow germs that glow in the dark under a black light. So we have people put lotion on their hands, then they have to go wash their hands, and they go through the clean part of the clean tent and see where they missed. And we talk to them about it's the friction of rubbing your hands, it's how long you wash your hands, sing happy birthday to yourself twice, and it's the use of soap. The one thing we have seen, and I brought for everyone here, use of nail brushes is actually recommended. I would say in terms of risk, it'd be better to use a nail brush than an antibacterial soap. And I'll put these out here so anybody can take them home. We do give these, maybe the page. You want to put those out? We'll put those out for everyone. So that's your take-home message for the day. So the policy of the health department is antibacterial soaps are no more effective than plain soap and water for killing disease-causing germs outside of healthcare settings. There's no evidence that antibacterial soaps are more effective than plain soap for preventing infection under most circumstances in the home or in public places. Therefore, plain soap is recommended in public, non-healthcare settings and in the home unless otherwise instructed by your doctor. The antibacterial, the soap debate, antibacterial or regular, we have a quote from Mayo Clinic staff, despite its soaring popularity, antibacterial soap is no more effective at killing burns, germs than regular soap. And using antibacterial soap may lead to the development of bacteria that are resistant to the product's antimicrobial agents, making it even harder to kill these germs in the future. And that last piece, at best, all we can say is it's inconclusive. We have not seen super germs developing, but again, it's an issue of risk. Is this chemical necessary in soap? You know, what's the intended use of the product? So that's my testimony, if you have any questions.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ma'am, were you involved in that ban that came out, I guess, yesterday by the state? Did you have any involvement in that ban of triclosan?
Madam Chair, Representative, not directly. I was aware of it. The Pollution Control Agency worked with the governor's office, and they're here to answer questions on that if you want to talk about that ban.
We can do that. Any other questions, members? Representative
Chair. So I'm just wondering, Ms. Bremer, if you would want to weigh into the discussion of developmental phase exposure of these substances as compared to the threshold of the level of exposure. And if not, perhaps it is. Maybe it's not your department, but I just wanted to see if you wanted to. I think you heard the question earlier.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I can go back and talk to my toxicologists and see if they can get you an answer on that. I don't want to weigh in on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. You said in your testimony that you don't recommend using the antibacterials unless instructed by your physician?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian.
Okay, so under what circumstances would a physician recommend using something else other than soap? And what would they have the patient use instead of soap and water?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, I would never question a doctor's orders, so I don't know under what circumstances they would prescribe that. I'm not an MD.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I see no other questions. Thank you so much for coming. We have next Trevor Russell, Friends of the Mississippi. We want to, we're glad you're here. We want to make sure that we do get the chemistry folks in, and I think then PCA after that. We are just because of the weather, we shortened up today, and I think we're going to have to do the clean water later, but I'm not sure. We'll see if we can.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representatives, thank you for having me here today. My name is Trevor Russell. I'm the Watershed Program Director with Friends of the Mississippi River. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization based in St. Paul. We work to protect, preserve, and enhance the Mississippi River throughout the Twin Cities region. I'm a little uncomfortable today because I shook a number of hands, and like Representative Fabian, yeah. I can do some math, and the numbers don't look good, so I appreciate that testimony from the Department of Health. I'm also here today because through part of my work, I am the author of the State of the River Report, and this is a report that we developed in partnership with state agencies and about 30 research scientists looking at the status and trends of the Mississippi River over the last 30 to 35 years or so. And one of the indicators we included in that report was triclosan. We actually took an excerpt after that report, and I think it's been passed out to this group, and I can get report copies to you if you're interested in more information. We ran out of print copies. We'll have some more coming shortly. We've had about 15,000 people look at that report online. I've presented to public forums, presentations, and panels about 30 times in the last few months and directly presented that information to about 1,200 Minnesotans. And I share that with you because I've got a lot of questions and queries from the public from all across the state, from St. Cloud to Rochester, throughout the metro area, from Wells Fargo Bank to the Isaac Walton League. And many of these questions come up about triclosan. And so in my duties in my organization, I've sort of been fielding those questions, and I thought I would share with everyone kind of what are some of the questions that we get a lot when we're out in the field. The first are, what are the main risks associated with triclosan? And I think we've seen some testimony here today. There's some potential human health risks, some concerns about the development of resistant bacteria, and then some pretty well-developed concerns about environmental buildup of triclosan-derived dioxins in our environment. In terms of exposure, we know that it's present in the urine of about 75% of Americans. A CDC study found that triclosan can pass through the human body and be excreted largely as unchanged triclosan up to several days after exposure, and that urinary levels of triclosan increased by 42.3%. Just between a 2003 and 2004 study and a 2005 and 2006 study. So at least in those two studies, we're seeing increasing concentrations of triclosan in our bodies, in our urine. We know that triclosan is a suspected endocrine disruptor, and there are published studies that establish it can lead to increased allergy susceptibility, at least in humans under the age of 18. We don't do lab studies on humans, though, so we can't say here's the exact health impact of triclosan in your body, but we do a number of lab studies. We look at biological organisms that have similar systems to our own. Sheep have very similar reproductive systems. Frogs and amphibians have very similar endocrine systems. So we study these animals to give us a window into how these contaminants may impact our bodies. Triclosan has been shown to disrupt muscle function in mice. Triclosan can have hypothermic effects, lowering body temperature, and can have nonspecific depressant effects in the central nervous system of mice. Studies have found triclosan can disrupt thyroid hormone expression in tadpoles at environmentally relevant levels, levels that we see in our environment now. It's been shown to interfere with healthy fetal development in sheep. Again, we have similar systems to them. Recent research has also linked triclosan exposure to reduced sperm production in male rats. We found it in dolphins off the coast of Florida and South Carolina. UC Davis research found triclosan interfered with muscle function in fish, that's been talked about, and that same study found mice showed up to a 25% reduction in heart function measured within 20 minutes of exposure to triclosan. While clearly additional research is underway, I think that these studies in aggregate suggest that there are potential health risks associated with this product to humans and in our environment, and we urge continued action at the state level. I won't touch on bacterial resistance issues except to reiterate the Minnesota Department of Health and the American Medical Association recommend against using antibacterial products in most home applications, specifically because they may contribute to the emergence of resistant strains of bacteria. I want to touch briefly on some of the environmental issues. I work for Friends of the Mississippi River, so we really care about how this stuff is expressing itself in our environment. We know that a USGS survey found triclosan in 58% of streams tested. Triclosan-derived dioxins have increased by 2 to 300% in Lake Pepin sediment just since the 60s, while levels of all other dioxins declined between 73 and 90% and that's in Professor Arnold's study. We know triclosan that makes it into the river is also an active pesticide. Remember, this is a pesticide regulated by the EPA. So it can act as such in our river systems as well. Triclosan can impact aquatic algae and other aquatic organisms, threatening the base of the aquatic food chain with unknown results on higher-up organisms such as ourselves. And then lastly, Professor Arnold touched on land application of triclosan in biosolids. By the way, the Met Council Environmental Services doesn't like us to use the word sludge. They prefer us all to use the word biosolids when referring to solid material taken out of our wastewater treatment systems. Locally, about 75% of that is incinerated. And we don't have good research on the fate of triclosan in incinerated biosolids. We do know that about 25% is applied as field fertilizer. Annually, an estimated 100,000 pounds of triclosan are field applied each year in the United States. One study found that environmentally relevant concentrations of triclosan in field applied sludge remained 266 days after application. So it's not as if we apply it and it goes away. It can stay in our ecosystem for a long period of time. And Mr. Arnold referenced a couple studies that show it can start to work its way up into the edible portions of food. Two particular products, radishes. I don't like radishes, so that doesn't bother me that much. But also soybeans were two of the vegetables where triclosan started to work its way up into the edible portion of the food that would start to get into our food supply. Soybeans are the second largest planted acreage in Minnesota next to corn. And we are concerned about the potential for triclosan entering our food system. We've talked about some consumer choice options. The American Medical Association recommends avoiding the use of triclosan products for household applications. Food and Drug Administration has found no evidence that households that use antibacterial products are any healthier than households that use soap and water and other cleaning products. We urge folks to use plain old soap and water, wash your hands properly, wash your hands regularly, and if you're concerned about bacteria on your hands, you can use alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Those do not contain triclosan, and we're not aware of any triclosan-related impacts through the use of those products. While we do applaud the governor for taking action yesterday to ask state agencies, require state agencies to avoid the use of these products, and we also note that some manufacturers have already replaced or are phasing out the use of this product. Colgate Palmolive was mentioned. I believe that was antibacterial dish liquid was the product that they took triclosan out of. Also, its soft soap, liquid soap, has been reformulated without the chemical. Johnson & Johnson has removed this chemical from all of its products or is phasing it out by 2015, I should say. Kaiser Permanente, a large hospital chain in California, has already banned use of this in its soaps in its hospitals and other healthcare facilities. So there's substantial public interest associated with the continued use of triclosan. It doesn't really do any good for our hands. We know it's building up in our environment. It may have antibacterial resistance consequences. We're not sure. But we do know that it's building up in our environment. And so on behalf of FMR, our board members, our members, and our volunteers, we urge continued action to prevent continued buildup of triclosan and its dioxin derivatives in our Mississippi River system. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Interested in your comments about the triclosans showing up in soybeans. Wondering if that's an actual field situation or in a test situation and what levels you're talking about. And then I was just trying to do some quick math here. I would imagine most of that would be applied in the fall, August, for example, and soybeans are planted the following spring in April or May. That's about 260 or 70 days. So with that delay in timing, you talked about 280 days life of that chemical. Would it still be around the next spring when the beans are actually planted?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that research was conducted by Professor Halden at ASU, and these, to my knowledge, were lab studies with multiple different, sludge diluted or triclosan in a water, soluble water or with biosolids, but it was not a field study. So I can, if you would like, get some of that information and get that out to the committee.
If you would give us that study, we will make sure members get it.
Okay.
Well, typically in a farm situation, you would not apply sludge to a field that's going to be planted with soybeans. Mm-hmm. So it would be more like a year and 8 or 9 months before you would grow soybeans on a field that had sludge applied to it. So the timelines are dramatically different than what was utilized in this lab study. Could you tell me, compare the concentration of triclosan in toothpaste compared to the concentration of triclosan in a radish or a soybean?
Madam Chair, Representative, first to your point and then to your question. These were not field studies of field applied biosolids in soybean growth, so it's difficult to say if that would have any impact. I think the studies were designed to explore whether or not triclosan can work its way up into the edible portions of plants. So your point is well taken. I think the study was really just an exploration of whether or not there's a risk there. In terms of relative concentration of triclosan in, was it toothpastes and things like that, where we would sort of have direct ingestion or dermal exposure compared to radishes and soybeans, I need to go back and look at that research. We did not include that in our State of the River report because that was sort of beyond the level of detail for our audience, but we can look at that. My expectation is that concentrations were far, far lower in the edible portions of plants than they would be found in direct consumer use products at home.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, you're raising the flag of concern at a level that is so low that it's almost undetectable, and I would like to see the information of relative concentrations.
Okay, I think we'll do Representative Hamilton, Representative Ward, and then ask the Cleaning Institute to come up.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Torkelson clarified, I guess, my question. But, you know, when it comes to finding a cause for anything that impairs muscle functions, I'd be the first one to be all over it. However, I'm not an alarmist. And there's a reason why these are in our products. And I guess a question to the testifier, you laid out the risks. What are the benefits?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I'll leave that to the Cleaning Institute, who's going to provide testimony immediately following me. So I would suppose I would leave that to them. They're the best people to elaborate on the benefits of their product. I think the purpose of my testimony here is simply to point out that having traveled the state, presenting information, and interacting with Minnesotans from all walks of life, there is clear concern that the buildup of triclosan in our bodies and our environment is of concern. I don't consider that sort of raising the alarm any more so than other folks are simply sharing the data and what little we know about this product. But we, as an organization, are concerned about its you know, clear link to dioxin development in our river ecosystem.
And Madam Chairman, and to the testifier, I mean, if you're going to raise the awareness and whatnot, I would caution you on how you do that. I mean, the prime example is what you said about the soybeans. And, you know, I guess we lose credibility if we're running around as alarmists. And I'm asking about the benefits because the individuals that were testifying from the University of Minnesota said one of the benefits is to eliminate or to address gingivitis. And I'm thinking that's not a little benefit. That's a great benefit. And so I do want to hear from the individuals in the products. Like I said, and I want to be very clear, if whatever causes anything that impairs muscle function, in humans and whatever else, I'd be all over that. But you know, the testifier that from the University of Minnesota said there's pros and cons, there's benefits and there's not, and we need to fully understand that. And when you're hearing the testimony, there's a lot of words like it may and potential and everything else, yet here we're making decisions off of what seems to be inconclusive evidence. And for me, that's concerning. Thank you.
Representative Ward, she's going to hold. And with that, thank you.
Thank you.
And we will welcome the president of the American Cleaning Institute, who we're inviting up early because he has a plane to take out this afternoon, but there are other folks who want to testify, and we had let them know we were going to be going on until this evening. welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and representatives on the committee. I appreciate you making some time for me to speak at this moment. And
would you put your name on the record, please?
Yes. It's Richard Sedlak, Executive Vice President of the American Cleaning Institute for Technical International Affairs. By background, I'm a biologist and environmental engineer with 35 years' experience with consumer product chemicals, primarily in the environment, but also human safety. A lot has been put on the table to discuss from the previous speakers, but I want to point out that some detailed comments were submitted in writing for the committee to look at. I won't go into those. I'll just hit some high points, some top lines to be very brief. First, we're talking about products that are used by consumers around the world, throughout the United States, and a whole myriad of products. And I hope the committee appreciates the breadth of use of triclosan as an antimicrobial ingredient. It provides a key public health benefit in antibacterial wash soaps, which my organization represents, in reducing germs on the hands, germs on the body. And this, in turn, reduces infection rates. One of the issues that has come up in today is a reiteration of an FDA statement and some other statements that these products don't have a benefit. Well, clearly there are hundreds of studies showing they kill germs on the hands. That's a given. But in 2005, the Food and Drug Administration did have an outside advisory panel saying, we want to see a reduction, a study that looks at reduction in infection rates. Since 2005, our industry has worked with universities and experts in the U.S. to create that data, and that data has been submitted to the Food and Drug Administration, and we're waiting for their review. It directly ties the reduction of germs on the hands due to triclosan to reduction of intestinal disease. And we're hoping it is adequate for them, but we're ready to hear their comments. So our industry stands firmly behind the benefits in reducing infectious disease that these products provide. And that is something that clearly is recognized in the medical setting. What I want to point out to you is we hear the medical setting being an important place to have these products retained. Another one is in food handler operations. I want to point out that these situations occur in the home. People are sick. People are immunocompromised. People are coming home from outpatient surgery. They use these products as well as the routine use by a consumer. So these instances are in the home. Dr. Arnold really covered the environmental side pretty well. Basically, wastewater treatment plants do pull out triclosan very, very efficiently. And as a result, the levels in Minnesota waters, wastewaters, environmental waters, are way below action levels that the state has set, that other states have set, that EPA has seen. So right now, environmental assessment would say that there's no impact on wildlife, fish in the state. This product is regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, and as such, in 2008, they issued a registration for it that had a very comprehensive environmental safety assessment done. This assessment looked at all sources of triclosan in the environment and concluded that throughout the waters in the U.S., the levels of triclosan were safe in the waters. And the data that is now new in Minnesota fits within the assessment. It doesn't take us to a point where we would upend what EPA has concluded about the safety of this material. As far as antibacterial soaps go, this product is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration under a tentative final monograph from 1994, and they do take enforcement action on the basis of that. And I guess two other points that have come up that I'll comment on is antibiotic resistance. There have now been two studies in the home looking for antibiotic resistance to develop in triclosan-using families. It did not occur. They've been published in peer-reviewed journals, and FDA now has these in their hands. And the 2010 European Commission did the most recent review of antibiotic resistance and concluded triclosan was not causing it in Europe. Finally, two points that have come up in most recent talk. was the uptake by plants. Sludge in the U.S. is not applied to edible plants except in very limited situations. EPA estimates 1% of the municipal sludge is applied to edible plants annually, but some states prohibit it completely. So this is a matter that needs to be understood in the context of all the constituents in the sludge and not just triclosan. And then finally, this interesting study out of California about effect on heart muscle and contraction of muscle. Triclosan has an interesting attribute in that it doesn't want to stay in the human body. It passes through. And it doesn't want to stay in a test animal body either. So this research, in order to get these effects that they really wanted to create, injected triclosan into the test animals at ridiculously high doses, and that led to the observance of this. They themselves don't see this yet advanced to the point that they can say this occurs in people. And I want to leave that there, that this is still an avenue of research and serious question that it could actually occur in people. Mm-hmm. With that, I'll end there. Thank you very much.
We have a question from Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, sir. I just have a question about the sales performance of hand soaps that have triclosan or other antibacterial agents listed. As far as consumers are concerned, how does the sales of those products compare to soaps that do not have them for your industry? And can you tell me a little about the history of whether or not you have gained sales as a result of those antibacterial agents being listed on the bottles?
The companies that make the antibacterial soap do believe their customers look for the antibacterial claim for the use in the home. And the sales are fairly good. But again, companies find niches, and some companies use the material. I'm not kidding you. Some companies use it, and some don't, and they relate to the market that they're going forward. I don't have any sales figures to share with you, but if you'd like that, I could go back and ask some companies to share some publicly available information if they would help you.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair. Well, you know, many of these issues revolve around the question of whether this is a marketing strategy or not, and simply because consumers who probably don't know too much about the science, as I don't, might want to buy those products from a company that advertises the use of these antibacterial agents in the soaps. And there is a concern, do you agree, in the medical profession about the widespread use of these things by the general public rather than use as it had been in hospitals and other places like that? Or do you feel that triclosan kills all the bacteria and there's no concern, in your opinion, as to the strengthening, you know, resistance by these the bugs that we're trying to remove? It seems that is the issue for me. We know that antibiotics now are reaching a point where it's more and more difficult to stop some of these super bugs, certainly in the hospital settings. So there's no concern on the part of the industry that you are exacerbating the problem by the widespread use of these products in hand soaps. Is that your position?
Our position would be vigilance. Right now, there is no evidence in either clinical studies in the home. You can create this in the laboratory, clearly, but you can't create it in the home. You don't see it in the home. And it hasn't been reported for triclosan in medical facilities either. So when we look at antibiotic resistance, we look at what the FDA is saying and CDC, and they have identified two major causes of antibiotic resistance: the use in livestock of antibiotics and the overuse by physicians. And their sessions focus on those. They don't focus on our products. I mean, we follow this very closely. There are surveillance programs, though, where they do swab people and understand whether there's microbes developing on the skin, and it's just not turning up here or in Europe where it's heavily studied too.
We are over time, and when you brought up the antibiotic resistance by the use in the production of animal foods, I think you raised a whole new issue for this committee, and so it's probably a good time. Just, is that okay, a good time to stop? So with that, I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Members, we are in recess, and we will hear from folks about clean water. We will have some more folks from industry talking about triclosan, and we have asked folks about problem solving with regard to groundwater, and that's our evening agenda. Members, we will reconvene. There are other committee members, committees going on where people are going to come in and go out, but we will tape all of this for folks who are not here. So first on our agenda is Dr. Timothy O'Brien and Jason Grieve, I think, want to come up together. And members, as they're settling in, I just want to note that there's a letter from a former Girl Scout, I suppose a Girl Scout, once a Girl Scout, always a Girl Scout, who testified at the legislature, not in a committee that I was in, but about 10 years ago, about triclosan. So this is not a new issue, and I think it would be interesting. Do you all have the letter from Hannah Nesser?
Yes, we do.
Okay, fine. Good.
Thank you.
All right. With that, welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jason Grieve. I'm the Director of Government Relations with Ecolab, based right here in St. Paul, started in 1923. As a little background, Ecolab employs about 3,000 Minnesotans, and about 40,000 employees worldwide. And in addition to being based in downtown St. Paul, we have our Global Research and Development Center based in Eagan, Minnesota as well. So we're a proud corporate citizen of Minnesota and glad to be here. Ecolab is the global leader in cleaning, sanitizing, and disinfecting in commercial settings. And you know, we provide products to numerous industries, including healthcare, food safety, which includes restaurants and food processing facilities, pest elimination, laundry care, ware washing of dishes and utensils, and industrial and institutional water care. We provide a lot of the cleaning products for the Capitol complex as well. So, regarding the use of triclosan, we're solely focused on healthcare applications and food safety applications. We are not a consumer company. We're solely focused on the commercial applications of triclosan in those areas. Number one, in the healthcare industry, triclosan is a critical antimicrobial ingredient in the fight against healthcare-associated infections. Every year, approximately 100,000 people die of healthcare-associated infections, and triclosan is a critical ingredient in protecting against those HAIs. And for background purposes, Ecolab services approximately close to 170 hospitals just in the state of Minnesota with cleaning products and services for that purpose. Secondly, in food safety, triclosan is critical for the prevention of foodborne illnesses in food processing and food handling applications. So Ecolab provides services to thousands of restaurants across the state and close to 300 food processing facilities as well. So we are well ingrained on these issues and glad to be here talking about it. And I know earlier this morning there were a number of valid concerns raised in regards to various research and studies that have been done on triclosan, and it looked like really wasn't certain that there was a lot of agreement in regards to those studies and research. But one thing that's certain for Ecolab is that we have a responsibility to our customers to maintain the highest standard in food safety and healthcare applications. Now, it seems like from what we've seen, there is some agreement that triclosan is a necessity in healthcare applications. But today, we also want to maintain that in food processing and food safety, that triclosan is also a critical ingredient there as well. We've seen from the governor's executive order that there looked like there might be an exemption there in regards to for medical purposes, but we want to make sure that, that you're aware of the food processing and food safety perspective as well. Now, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Tim O'Brien, and then we'd be happy to take questions together.
Welcome, Dr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the entire committee. Really grateful for the opportunity to speak here tonight. A little bit of my background, and actually I think it's very pertinent to the topic that's being discussed here around triclosan. I have a history, actually I formerly managed a wastewater treatment plant collection system for the city of Superior, Wisconsin. I am a licensed wastewater operator, had been a licensed wastewater operator, so I'm very familiar with the issues surrounding the discharge of chemical substances and their remaining in the environment or in the sediments downstream of wastewater plants. And I also have a PhD from the University of Minnesota Medical School. I studied at the University of Minnesota Duluth, the medical school there, and my topic was the metabolism of exogenous chemicals in the human body, primarily the liver. And so I'm very familiar with the issues around health, safety, and chemical products. My role at Ecolab is I'm the director, the global director of product safety and compliance, as well as the corporate toxicology. So that's kind of a little bit of my background and experience, which I think is relevant to the topic tonight. As Jason said, I think this morning there was a lot of conversation around the study that was conducted by the University of Minnesota staff. Dr. Arnold and his team did a very good job. The purpose of that study, I think we really want to make sure everyone aware of again, is that they were intended to determine the presence or absence or lack thereof of triclosan in the sediments downstream of wastewater treatment plants and receiving waters. And that really was the entire purpose of that study. And they had identified triclosan and its degradates in the sediments in these locations. I think drawing any additional conclusions from that study regarding human health or environmental health is not appropriate, but there are other studies out there, and there's more work that needs really to be done to address those concerns. So if you think of a risk to the environment or public health, we have this exposure piece. Whether that exposure in the sediments is relevant or not has to be established, and what that impact on the environment is yet to be determined. And so that's just a high level. I think it was a study that was very well done. It was published in a very reputable journal, and I have no difficulties or problems with the way the study was conducted. In terms of Ecolab, as Jason had noted previously, we are primarily concerned about the use of triclosan in three primary areas. Actually, two of them involve food safety, and one is the healthcare environment. We understand we have quite an agreement around the use of triclosan in healthcare settings to prevent hospital or healthcare acquired infections. And the other two areas are in food handling applications. One is in food processing facilities, and I spoke briefly with our marketing teams this afternoon, and Ecolab supplies chemicals to about 70% of the food processors in the state of Minnesota. And the applications of use of triclosan in those areas are for hand washing and during food prep in kitchens in the back of the house with many restaurants there that are customers, and also in food manufacturing or meat and poultry facilities. The gremlins are about. And so, and really, in many of our if I can speak first about the food processing facilities, the meat and poultry plants, or the food and beverage facilities, bottling plants, where they use triclosan is when you enter the plant, you have to wash your hands. And the USDA gives guidance around having antimicrobial or hand washing and antimicrobial application. So there's two ways you can do that. You can wash with an antimicrobial product, hand soap, like a triclosan-containing product, or you can wash with a non-antimicrobial soap, a standard hand soap, and use a alcohol hand sanitizer as the sanitizing step. Our customers in the food processing industry, we actually have spoken with them. They really prefer a hand wash that contains an antimicrobial like triclosan, and they generally prefer triclosan over the two-step process. Number one, because alcohol is very drying. These alcohol hand sanitizers, which are leave-on, they're drying to their staff's hands. And you figure somebody in a food processing plant, they generally have to they have to wash their hand every time they leave the floor, every time they touch their face, every time they do anything with their hands other than their job. And so you're going to have individuals having to wash their hands, you know, who knows, 15, 20 times a day at least, maybe more. And so you consider applying alcohol hand sanitizers to your hand that many times a day. There's a drying component to that. The second piece is, a lot of these facilities do not like having alcohol hand sanitizers in the facility because of the flammability. That these are industrial facilities, there are industrial processes in place, and they try to limit the amount of flammable materials like alcohol near some of these processing equipment. So their preference, again, is a one-step process, hand washing with antimicrobial product, and every one of them requires this. This is, if we were to go to our customers and say, well, we don't have an antimicrobial hand soap for you, this is one of their standard protocols that they need to meet in order to meet USDA guidelines. And they firmly require that in their places, in their place of business. And then secondly, of course, is the other area of food handling, of course, is the back of the house of restaurants. And again, it's the same question around the cooks or the chefs or the food prep staff. They are required to wash their hands and make sure they're maintaining a clean workplace environment. And and again, our customers really, for the most part, insist on having an antimicrobial or antibacterial hand wash to protect food safety. Again, the question always comes, if you have a customer that gets ill from a foodborne illness and your staff has not properly washed their hands or not appropriately protected the customers from a foodborne illness, that account is, you know, taking the task. It's in the newspaper. There's the health department's going to be wondering what's going on in this facility. And so to best protect their customers and their business reputation, they prefer to have a triclosan-containing product. And finally, I guess, just in terms of options, I know the conversation has arisen. What are the options for replacement of a triclosan? And the FDA, these topical antimicrobial products are governed, the active ingredients are governed by the FDA. And there are only about 6 or 7 topical antimicrobial active ingredients that are approved for use. And so it's not that you can go out and create a new one or just use any ingredients for antimicrobial practice. You have to use one that's one of the approved drugs that the FDA has addressed. So that's really the primary comments. I think, again, that the healthcare environment, we're pretty much in agreement on. I think that's necessary. And Ecolab's perspective is the industrial food use and the back-of-the-house restaurant use. We still believe this is a critical area for public health and food safety, and would respectfully ask the committee to consider that as you move this your decisions forward.
Well, just to be clear, we do not have a bill before this committee.
Okay.
The reason we had the testimony that we did this morning is because we funded that study with your lottery dollars, and it was clearly cutting edge, peer-reviewed, and it did bring up the issue of dioxin, which we have made lots of efforts in other ways to reduce it. Mm-hmm. So to see it expand is probably not where we want to go. So I would say it is not where we want to go. So all of us are running into these new issues of unintended consequences, and it's very hard to figure out what to do in the case of unintended consequences. And I think that's one of the things that's happening here, because nobody anticipated that when triclosan went through a wastewater treatment system where there was chlorine, then you produce dioxin. So that was not, I don't think anybody anticipated that. There's no other science that speaks about it. But we do not have a bill before us. There, I'm confident one will be introduced. I'm not the author, but I am confident a bill will be introduced so we can, so we have all these obligations in this committee in particular to our major fishing industry, tourism industry, I should say, and we do see fish under stress. There's no question about that. Major stress with reproduction. So all these things become very serious for us. Questions? I actually have a question for one of my colleagues, and just because you're corn producers. The cleaning agents that I use at home are all citric acid based, or that's the power in them. Does that come from corn?
I'm not sure which corn producer you want to talk to, Madam Chair, but I believe that citric-based cleaners use oranges as their source of citric acid.
Mm-hmm. I thought that corn also produced citric acid.
It may. I'm not an expert on everything that corn does, but as far as cleaning products, I believe that citric acid does come from oranges and byproducts of orange processing.
If I may, Madam Chairperson, we at Ecolab do use citric acid in some products, and actually the product is usually a manufactured citric acid. It comes from a variety of sources, and you buy this in bulk quantities, and some of it may be from oranges, some of it are from other processes, but they are organic in nature generally, so it's from existing, bio crops or wherever you may want to say.
I think we're going to pursue the notion, and I don't know why that stuck in my mind as one of the sources of citric acid, because I know there are these huge, Restore is what I use, and there's a lot of, every part of the label says citric acid.
Madam Chair, if you like citric acid, I'm happy to take credit for producing it.
I do. So, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I wonder about is when we're talking about different kinds of ways to control bacteria, I think back at in the 60s, the big thing to use was Physahex. I don't know if you remember that, but that was the thing to do to get rid of staph infections, strep infections. I particularly remember it because my siblings and I were sharing boils at the time, and we used it a lot. But I did a little research and found out that in 1969 we got rid of that and replaced it with triclosan because they believed then that Physahex may have caused cancer. Although I suppose it still could happen. We're not that old, but nobody's had cancer yet. So, and we use it considerably. But my concern is triclosan helps to eradicate things like MRSA, And I read some information here that says that it helped to protect newborns, and you know, I'm wondering, would something like citrus soaps do the same thing? Because MRSA is pretty serious.
That's correct, Madam Chairwoman and Representative Peel. The fact that actually, in order to make a claim, for example, like citric acid or as an antimicrobial, actually the U.S. EPA has to approve any claims of antimicrobial effectiveness for any chemical substance. In terms of triclosan and use in a healthcare environment, it's actually one, there are many tools, and those tools include hard surface cleaning, so you need to go into place, and this is where you'd use, you know, you clean the bed rails, you clean the floors, you clean the walls. That's one. Number two, you also have barrier protection. So there's these physical barriers to protect the patient from the doctor or whatever it might be. Then also you have the skin protection on the patient, where you apply at a surgical site, you'll apply a betadine or something like that to kill the topical organisms. And then hand cleaning is really critical. All of those tools are absolutely necessary to prevent healthcare acquired infections. And in fact, there was a case in which a MRSA outbreak in a hospital in the Chicago area, in which in the end it was a variety of Ecolab products, including a triclosan containing product, that actually was able to knock down that MRSA infection in that particular ward. So it's really a whole tool belt of chemistries that are required to actually protect the, you know, public health in that case. And actually, we would also say the same for food preparation areas as well. It's the same things: hard surface cleaning, barrier, and hand cleaning.
Thank you for that. I trusty internet has given me the answer to the corn question, and it corn can yield these carbohydrates. So there was this little process up here. So yes, it is possible to produce citric acid from corn. So
using malt, by the way.
Pardon?
They actually use mold to process the corn byproducts, and so the mold, the mold is our friend.
Okay, it's probably not unlike my sourdough yeast bread, right? Which is pretty sour.
I'd be happy for a sample, Madam Chair. Pass my supper time.
Okay, we'll work on that. Any other questions for our testifiers? We appreciate your coming down and chatting with us. I think if I were in your shoes, I would be surprised. Would have been surprised about the research from our civil engineering department. So I understand the concern, and I think we're going to have to think through how we avoid some of the unintended consequence here.
Right.
So,
thank you for your time.
Representative Clark, you had a question.
Is this Ecolab report, is this from you?
Actually, yes, I wanted to make that point. This is a report that was produced by Dr. Bruce Cords, who a longtime associate at Ecolab, and he published this for us in 2010. And it's really a study, kind of a compilation of studies regarding the use of antimicrobial hand cleaners in food processing applications. And this is available for your perusal, and I'd be more than happy to return and speak to this document.
Madam Chair?
I'll ask members of any question.
Could I just ask one question? I just was looking on page 9 where you have hand hygiene is a leading contributor to foodborne illness. Number 2 is bare hand contact by food handlers, 25%. Number 14 is gloved hand contact by food handlers, 6%. So are we talking here about gloved hands that are dirty? Dirty gloves?
Yes. So you have these plastic gloves or latex gloves that people use behind the counter, and they don't discard them, and they rub their face just like they would with their hands, or they're touching other surfaces. So, yes, that's exactly what happens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So they're not protecting the food or anything. They're actually protecting maybe their own hands, but they're contaminating food going back and forth, and it gives the appearance that they're, I know, I see that a lot. I've seen that a lot. I really I hadn't seen a study that had actually documented that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My question, since there are not a lot of us here, Does anyone want to hear from Pollution Control Agency about the process they used to determine that the state was not going to purchase products with triclosan? Yeah. You would like to? Ms. Moger, would you like to come down?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Kathy Moger. I'm the Sustainability Manager for the Pollution Control Agency, and I also serve as the chair of the Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team that was created under most recently Governor's Order, Executive Order 1113 regarding sustainability. But IPAT, as we finally call it, has been in existence since 1992 in one form or another. The Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team has the ability to modify model sustainability plans that are contained in the executive order. And in the case of the eliminating the purchase of hand soaps, dish, and laundry products containing triclosan by June 30th, this was one of several target changes that were made on February 28th. The context that we gave for the Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team to take this action is that the current state contract, which has been in existence, this is its fifth year, contains hand soaps and a preference for products that did not make any antimicrobial claims. And so the majority of hand soaps that are on contract, or have been for the last 5 years, are triclosan-free. We have a request for proposals that Department of Administration is working on for dishwashing and laundry compounds that requires those products to be triclosan-free. And Department of Administration expects to issue that contract by the end of this month, March 31st. However, under the executive order, the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency also has the ability to waive the requirement for meeting this particular target for good cause shown. And in the information that we provided to the Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team, we gave them examples of waivers where we expected that the commissioner would have to take that action, and that included medical and food safety needs. And so we've let the state agencies know that we would expect waivers in those areas for those particular parts of their facilities. So in other words, if they have an office building that's associated with food preparation and safety, the food preparation and safety area might have a waiver for triclosan to allow the use of those products. But in the restroom facilities where hand soaps are available that are triclosan free, and where the mechanical action of washing your hands and using the paper towels or the cloth towels would allow you to accomplish that same purpose, the expectation is that those would be triclosan-free. So that's the discussion that we had with the Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ma'am, is the Department of Health a member of your Interagency Advisory Team?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, yes.
Well, this morning we had somebody from that department here, and I asked if they had any, at least my intention was to ask if they had any input or into the decision, and the lady said no from the department. So are you saying they were part of that decision?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, we've been discussing target changes from for about the last two meetings of the Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team. I would have to go back to the attendance list to verify that a Department of Health person was in attendance at the actual February 28th meeting. I don't recall that off the top of my head, honestly.
And just one more question. We're coming off a season of a very severe flu outbreak in the nation, and a lot of emphasis placed on hand sanitation. With that in mind, or if that were to come up again, would you still recommend that the triclosan not be part of the regimen used to reduce the chance of spreading of influenza?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm a planner. I'm not a scientist. So I can tell you what we do in our office building, which was part of the state recommendations, which was to have the alcohol sanitizers in all of our public areas. And, you know, people use them frequently during the flu season. So they're outside every elevator. They're in every conference room. You know, we try and take precautions so that we're not passing germs to each other.
Representative Clark. Madam Chair, I don't know if this is the right person, maybe even somebody from Ecolab, but we're talking about the antibacterial activities. What about antiviral activities? Because when we're talking about the flu, we're not necessarily talking about bacteria. So my question, I don't know if you're the person to be asking that, but the impact on viral contamination.
Madam Chair, and
looks like maybe one of our Ecolab people might
the right person.
We can ask the Department of Health that question and get it back to committee members.
Okay,
we'll make sure that that question is asked. Any other questions for Ms. Moger? Thank you for coming up. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to talk about the testimony we have had today on triclosan, or offer any opinions? I don't see anybody. So with that, we will go on. One of the things we talked about earlier is we have clearly some issues with groundwater in the state, and at the beginning of our groundwater two hearings, I offered and asked if people would do some problem solving and come and visit us with a problem solving attitude. And so we had said that we would do that about this time, and this is the time. So I'm going to welcome anyone to come up to talk about public comment on water resources. And we'll start with Pat Sweeney from the Freshwater Institute. No, I don't think so. Let me do it. We might later. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Pat Sweeney. I'm the Research and Communications Director for the Freshwater Society.
Society, I'm sorry.
We're a 44-year-old nonprofit based in Orono. We say our mission is to educate and inspire people to value, conserve, and protect water resources. And since 2008, we've been particularly focused on groundwater sustainability and non-point pollution of lakes and streams. In 2008, we issued a report on both ground and surface water. It wasn't original research. It was not original research. It was an effort by us to review and then make accessible to the public research on groundwater that had been done by other agencies like the DNR, the U.S. Geological Survey, and the Minnesota Geological Survey. Our major conclusions and recommendations at that time were that among groundwater experts, there seemed to be a lack of consensus about whether Minnesotans' use of groundwater was sustainable in the long term. Groundwater use was increasing faster than population growth, and we questioned the then prevailing practice by the DNR of basically evaluating each request for a permit to pump groundwater on a case-by-case basis, in which after a well was drilled, there would be a test pumping period to see if it interfered with neighboring wells. And we called for the state to move to a practice in which permitting would be based on cumulative impact on the aquifer of the wells already pumping and the ones that the owners of wells who wanted to put in wells to pump in the future. This year we're updating that report, and Representative Wagenius invited me here to give you a preview. In beginning that, one of the first things we did was attempt to determine how accurate is the DNR's big database of reported pumping by about 7,500 high-capacity wells. We wanted, first of all, to find out if there were wells that should be in the database that were not. And we did that by comparing a much, much larger database from the Health Department of about 130,000 wells that were drilled between 2000 and 2010, and then looking at the DNR's database from 2000 through 2012 to see which of those wells ended up being having permits issued for appropriation of groundwater. We looked only at commercial, industrial, and irrigation wells. We looked at wells with a casing 8 inches or larger, because the well experts told us that was the size well that nobody would drill unless they expected to pump 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year, which is the state standard for permitting. Some people said a six-inch well was that type of high-capacity well. We used the 8 inches. In that comparison of the two databases, we found about 500 of those large wells, which was 20% of the total drilled over those 10 years, that seemed not to have received water appropriation permits from the DNR. Most of those high-capacity wells were most of those high-capacity wells together were irrigation wells, and most of the ones that seemed not to have the required permits were irrigation wells. When we went to the DNR, they told us the agency knew that some well owners failed to apply for permits even when the DNR nagged them to do it, but the agency often failed to push the issue and demand compliance with the rule. The DNR supervisors we talked to said proving a well actually is being used to pump 10,000 gallons a day is an extremely difficult and time-consuming task, as you can imagine it would be. We concluded that at least until fairly recently, the agency hadn't made rigorous enforcement of the permitting requirement a high priority. The DNR told us that the last year the agency began an investigation in two areas of heavy irrigation in the Bonanza Valley and in the Straight River near Park Rapids. And they concluded, based on the results they were getting from that investigation, that about 10% of the irrigation wells that should have permits did not have them. The DNR said it's now making a serious effort to bring those well owners into compliance. And I have to stress that the freshwater review didn't prove that any well owners were not getting permits required by law. We didn't go out to any farms or businesses to verify wells were pumping 10,000 gallons a day. As I said, that's difficult for anyone, including the DNR, to do. Our analysis was circumstantial evidence, which we hope the DNR will follow up on, that suggests some significant number of owners of high-capacity wells are not seeking the permits that the law requires and not making reports on their annual pumping as the law requires. And that's important for two reasons. First, there's a fee, that relatively small fee, that those people who don't get the permits avoid paying. That's a cost to the state, and it allows them to avoid a cost that their neighbors and business competitors are paying. Second reason why that's a bad thing is not having those wells in the database deprives the DNR of important information the agency needs to have when it evaluates whether current and projected pumping in a given aquifer is sustainable over the long term. Our report, when it's finished, will also point out that the reporting of how much water is pumped is all self-reported data. Our conclusion is that the DNR does not do too much and is not able to do too much to ensure the accuracy of those reports. And it's not just us saying that. The DNR, in one of its reports in 2010, said, and this is a quote, "The accuracy of reported water use depends more than it should on the equipment and the operator. Some of the currently allowable water use measurement methods are not accurate. Water use data would be improved if all water users metered the water used and kept the meters in good repair." Unquote. In our freshwater report, we're going to make three recommendations on the permitting issue. The first is that the DNR needs to put greater priority on enforcing the law requiring permits for high-capacity wells. The second is that the legislature should seriously consider requiring well owners to get permits to pump from high-capacity wells before the wells are drilled. Wisconsin and Michigan do that. Other states may. Our practice of having well owners spend thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of dollars to drill a well and install a pump and then seek a permit to use it does not make sense. The stakes are too high for the well owner, and it puts too much pressure on the DNR to issue the permit after the fact. The third recommendation will be that the legislature should seriously consider allowing the DNR to pursue administrative fines against people pumping groundwater without permits, rather than having to persuade a county attorney to file misdemeanor charges. The DNR says it has sought that authority from the legislature several times in the past. Beyond that, and this is probably the major thrust of our report, is simply looking at how groundwater use occurs and is growing, is that groundwater use, and especially for agricultural irrigation, is continuing to grow. Both irrigation and pumping by city water systems are growing at a rate that's faster than population growth. And on irrigation, we don't have a lot of land that's irrigated compared to many states. But agricultural irrigation is Minnesota's second largest user of groundwater, 58 billion gallons in 2011, and it is by far the fastest growing use. Over the last 5.5 fiscal years, the DNR issued more than 700 new or revised permits to pump 26 billion gallons of groundwater per year for irrigation. But the biggest user of groundwater still is city water systems, which pumped 126 billion. And it's another type of irrigation, in-ground lawn sprinkling systems, that's driving much of that increase. And our report is going to say there are a lot of good things going on, and I'm going to mention four of those now. The DNR says it's moving toward basing its permitting decisions on the cumulative impact of existing and planned pumping from an aquifer rather than making well-by-well decisions. We want to see evidence that that is happening. In 2010, the legislature gave the DNR commissioner authority to create groundwater management areas to ensure sustainable use of groundwater that protects ecosystems, water quality, and the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. We think that was far-sighted. We hope these groundwater management areas get created in the areas where groundwater pumping is or could become unsustainable. And we hope that the citizens in those areas will support taking action now to protect groundwater for our kids and our grandchildren. Third good thing that's going on is the legacy amendment provided money for groundwater research, and that research is going to tell us much more than we know now about the sustainability of our groundwater use. The fourth thing is that the top water planner at the Metropolitan Council is beginning to talk about the need for some communities, including some of those around White Bear Lake, to consider switching from wells to river water for their water supply. We think that makes sense and is something we recommended 4 years ago. Thanks very much for allowing me to make this presentation. If you have questions, I'll try to answer them.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sweeney, do you have any information as to how many days per year an average irrigation well is used?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I do not.
Would you assume it would be something less than 365?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I would assume that it's between May and September on selected days.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also, there's certainly variation in how much irrigation water is pumped dependent on the weather. Would you agree with that?
Madam Chair, Representative, it varies dramatically depending on the weather.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As far as city use goes, how many days a year do you think those city wells are pumping water?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think they are pumping 365 days a year, and I think the evidence is that they pump much more in the summer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And which of these two types of wells, which would allow for more recovery of the aquifer?
That is a question that even our scientists are having. I think we have to be a little fair here. We don't know the recharge rates, by and large, in Minnesota. We just don't know that, and that's one of the outstanding questions. Met Council has made some estimates of recharge in the metropolitan area, and we're clearly not recharging as fast as we are using. But we don't know about much of Minnesota. We just simply don't know because we don't have that kind of data, and that's one of our big gaps.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems that a system that's pumping 365 versus a system that is pumping occasionally and only in and most using most of its water in dry weather would certainly allow for more recharge. When the weather's wet and you're not pumping as much irrigation water, I would assume there's more recharge. Maybe I'm mistaken, Madam Chair.
Well, we could make that assumption, but we also have to ask the question, are we moving the water off the land too fast for recharge to happen? And I think in that case that we have in the metropolitan area, we're moving water off land too fast with our great big storm systems that are moving water off the land very fast. And in outstate Minnesota, we have tile drainage that's moving water off the land very fast. And we don't know the consequence, really, of either one of them. I think White Bear Lake has given us a taste of what can happen. Worthington has given us another taste of what can happen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, both of those examples certainly are have long histories behind them. It's not a brand new problem. They have had issues with ground with water for a long time. The only other dramatic difference I would point out is impervious surfaces. There's a very limited amount of impervious surface on my farm or anybody else's, as far as I know. And here in the city, of course, the percentage of impervious surfaces is quite high.
It's true. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You mentioned the Bonanza Valley. That happens to be just down the road from where I live, and it's an extremely valuable process out there. It's made that land productive and very valuable. And occasionally I've heard just anecdotally that a well has gone dry, but a new well is dug, and things go on. And didn't hear, as I recall, any problems last year in terms of wells going dry on a basis that would cause a lot of concern. That recharge has always been there. It's been the irrigation's been going on for a number of years in that area, and it always the recharge rate has been sufficient to allow a lot of irrigation in that area. So again, it's a very valuable practice that's done out there, and yeah, there's in dry periods of time, a lot of water is pumped, a lot of water is used by a lot of different entities in a dry period. But again, the irrigation, a very valuable practice, and we need to, if at all possible, allow that to continue out there.
Would you like to comment? I don't think there was a question there.
No, my reference to the Bonanza Valley is that's one of the areas that I have heard the DNR say where they have began to particularly look at this issue of unpermitted wells. And it may be because there are a great number of wells there.
And I think if we wanted, we could ask DNR to we could ask them if there's well interference currently going on in Bonanza Valley. Would DNR do that? Since Bonanza Valley has come up, and the questions I think are around, is there well interference in Bonanza Valley at this point?
Madam Chair, members, Jason Meckel, Department of Natural Resources. There are one for sure act of well interference complaint that we're still investigating in Bonanza Valley, and there were two over the last several years that we have investigated and have been resolved. They were found to be interferences that were legitimately because of high-capacity pumping nearby.
And when you say resolve, what does that mean for the person who has the well that is not producing as they anticipated?
Madam Chair and members, the each situation is unique. I believe in the case of Bonanza Valley, it was required that a new well be drilled for one of the homeowners. In the other case, I believe they had to modify the pumping, lower the pump in the well, and extend, basically modify it by extending it deeper down into the well to where there was water.
And who would pay for that?
My understanding, Madam Chair, is that the party that was identified as having interfered with took care of those costs.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair. Could you explain, there's a priority system that in case problems arise, the wells are shut off in a priority system, and isn't irrigation the first type of well that would be shut down?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, there is a priority system, and domestic supply is rated as the top priority in statute. However, there's also a statute that prevents us from telling irrigators they can't irrigate during the crop season. So it doesn't happen, essentially. We don't and haven't told an irrigator to turn off their irrigation system. Now, on groundwater in particular, on surface water, that has happened because what can happen is that the systems just essentially go dry to the point where they can't productively get water out. But it's very infrequent that an irrigator is told they cannot have water during the growing season. If that were to happen, and I don't recall the specific date in statute, but we have to notify an irrigator in the spring that there might be an issue that they wouldn't have water, and that just simply hasn't happened.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hesitate to ask a question I don't know the answer to, but the relationship between well drillers and the permitting process, are the drillers of wells required to notify the state when a well is drilled, and what kind of capacity that well is able to produce?
You want to do it?
Madam Chair, committee members, Chris Alvrum, Department of Health. The law requires that a notification be submitted to the health department before a well is drilled, and it doesn't require to report the volume anticipated, but it does require to report the anticipated use, and so from that you can determine whether or not it's for a domestic, for a home, or for irrigation, or for a city.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't they also record the depth and water, other information about the well when it's drilled?
Madam Chair, yes, after the well is drilled. So the notification comes in, and it has to be in essentially at any time before the well is drilled. So they could send a notification and drill the same day. After the well is drilled and constructed, within 30 days they have to submit a record of that well construction to us, which includes then the pump size and the depth and the anticipated volume.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And does that also include information as to the size of the well casing?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. And thank you, Madam Chair. And I assume the location and accurate record of the location of the well.
Madam Chair and committee members, the location is really by township range and down to the quarter section. And so we have not required to this date to be, accurate GPS locations, but that's something that we're looking forward to in the future.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then we've got all this information coming into the state as to where these wells are being drilled and how large they are and the anticipated capacity. How does that relate then to the permitting process?
Madam Chair and committee members, when a well notification comes in, it's in a few categories, such as irrigation, industrial, commercial, or public water supply, not the domestic. We do send a notice to the DNR to let them know that a well is being constructed that may require an appropriation permit. And then we also notify the well owner after that well is drilled that they, if they're going to use over this volume, that they need to get a permit from the DNR. And so the communication is made to the DNR, and then it's kind of left in their court to pursue the, ensure that the appropriation permit is obtained.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, then, where is the ball being dropped here? Is it the DNR? Is it the well owner? Is it the well driller?
Madam Chair and committee members, I would say that the responsibility falls to the well owner in most cases. The law states if you use over a certain volume, you have to get a permit. And the very large users, I think, probably understand that and get their permits. It's those that are kind of on the cusp, perhaps, that either don't know, they don't think they are using that volume, but the responsibility really falls to the well owner to apply and get that permit.
I'm done, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. One more question for the permitting guys as to the cost of a permit. I don't believe it's prohibitive. What about the cost of a permit to irrigate?
Madam Chair, the cost, There's a small fee when they send a notification, and $225 to the health department.
You will see in your packet, we put some examples of water fees actually paid. It's just one of the, as we learn this issue, this was one of the pieces of information that I had asked for. And you can see the cents per gallon paid and for ag irrigation. Somebody, since that's the thing that we're talking about, they pay a water use fee of $100, and then cents per gallon is 0.00069 cents per gallon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to the fee thing yet. I'm more interested in the permitting and what information the state requires. So what further information does the state gain in regard to wells when a permit is applied for?
You mean, Madam Chair, do you mean an appropriation permit?
I guess. I think that's the only... What other permits are there?
Madam Chair and Representative Perkleton, the... if I may, just to finish the question Representative Anderson had, you asked about fees. There is a permit application fee for appropriation permits, $140. And that's for any new application. And then, as Representative Wagenius was talking about, there's a use. So depending on how much you use in a given year, then there's an annual use fee that goes with it. Representative Torkelson, in terms of what information do we get from the permit, we get location information, et cetera, intended use, and then the request that they have for the amount of water, basically. And what happens then is if we review it, and we need to make a determination if this is an area where there may be other wells, known issues, we may require additional information such as short-term pump tests to determine how much water and water levels, some monitoring. It can vary depending on the location.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how long have you been acquiring that sort of information?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, I guess I don't know how far back into the statute those requirements go, but I believe they've been there for quite some time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, the information that you would actually use to... My understanding is that the DNR has been issuing permits pretty much that you would actually use to... My understanding is that the DNR has been issuing permits pretty much without qualification based on impact on the aquifer. Am I mistaken?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, if we think about the number of permits that we have, the vast majority of them have been issued over a very long period of time. More recently, as the intensity of use has increased in certain areas, and as we've gotten monitoring information about water levels, we've had to increase the request for information with these applications because concerns have developed, location to trout streams, fens, so on and so forth. So as we've recognized these issues, we've asked for additional information and tried to look more comprehensively. But many of these permits have been in existence for 30, 40, or 50 years, but it's the increasing density of them neighbor to neighbor. In some parts of the state, this is much more prevalent than others.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is, over what time period has this been ramping up?
Representative Torkelson and Madam Chair, I don't have an answer to that specific question.
I'm not sure I understand the question, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to, we've been realizing this impact apparently in fairly recent time, and my understanding is the DNR issued permits pretty much when they were requested in the past, but more recently we have started asking these more in-depth questions about the impact, potential impact of the well on the aquifer in relation to other wells in the area. I'm just trying to figure out if that's over the last 3 years or over the last 20 years. I'm not asking for an exact number. I realize it's been a gradual process, What I'm really trying to identify is this related to the drought or is it related to growing demand?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, in that context, I would say that it's probably been over the last 20 years, but it's been increasing in the last decade, and it really is location specific. When ethanol plants started to come online, that really then began driving a lot more of this because those are very high capacity systems. I think we were talking earlier about some of the ones in southwestern Minnesota that drove some of that. Some of the challenges in southwestern Minnesota with the rural water supply systems have required us to work very closely with communities to try to figure out what kind of pumping is sustainable and where in the various aquifers. And we've talked previously in our testimony about some of the challenges in that part of the state. So it's been a gradual ramp up, but for the past 20 years, certainly there's been a focus. It's just as Mr. Sweeney spoke to, there's a growth here, and that's driving the need.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm certainly not denying that. I'm just trying to get a handle on, you know, the scope. How many permits have been denied?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, it's very rare that a permit is denied outright. Usually the question is how much. And what has typically happened is an applicant would come in asking for a certain amount of water. We would do a preliminary evaluation based on the location, work with them on various tests. And at some point, we would do our best to figure out how much water we could sustainably allow an appropriation permit. Over a period of years of monitoring, we may need to readjust that. But it's typically not no, it's just how much in that given system, given the other users in the area and the nature of those aquifers, do we think we can sustain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the number of actual denied permits is very small.
Yeah, and I don't want to hazard a guess because I don't know.
One more question, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. As you permits come in an area where you think you have determined there is a stress on the available aquifer, do you ever adjust other people's usage? You know, looking at this as a group, and you say, well, they need this new well is a worthy cause or use for water. We're going to tell everybody else in the region that they need to cut back a bit so this guy can have water. Is that ever part of the process?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, that has not happened to date, although that is theoretically what would happen in a groundwater management area. Mr. Sweeney spoke to that new legislation in 2010 that says that the commissioner can set allocation limits and in a designated area. And Minnesota is a riparian rights state, so if you own land, you have the right to some water underneath. The question is how much? And that question really then is determined by who else is using, what are the priorities for those uses, and what can the aquifer sustain. And as Mr. Sweeney spoke to, there's a couple of areas in the state where we think the groundwater management areas is likely to be the way that we need to approach the management challenges based on the amount of use.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how would you determine these priorities?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, the priorities are set in statute in terms of domestic supply and down the line, irrigation being third, industrial uses, and so forth. The idea with a groundwater management area is that it's a matter of trying to bring all the parties together to figure out, given a certain limit, what can people live with. And we have not worked out any kind of process in terms of how a priority would get set, but ultimately the idea is that it's an agreed-to plan with the local interests at the table. The key for us is to just set what we think that sustainability limit is and then try to work within that.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Interesting topic. We've already agreed, I think, that the water used for irrigation in any given year can vary considerably based on the type of season. A wet year, you'd use less water. A dry year, more water. So when a producer comes in or applies for a permit to access a number of gallons of water, does he plan on the high side, the dry side, or how do you adjust as the season goes along if irrigation needs are greater than what somebody may have thought or had applied for?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, typically permit applicators will apply for what they think the maximum is that they might need in any given year. And my sense is that if I was an ag irrigator, I would apply for what I think I'm going to need to get a crop off that year if it doesn't rain at all. And frequently, if I look at what we have for permitted amounts versus what the actual amount used, typically the permitted amount is much higher than the actual amount used most years. When we get into dry years, then we see the situation where the actual amount used can get much closer to the permitted amount. But as I indicated, a lot of these permits were issued over a very long time ago, and so there's it tends to be a range. There's not a standard permitted amount of water on a per acre basis that's out there. In other words, there's not, if agriculture is not given a certain amount per acre, it really varies. And part of that's because of the soils, depending on where you are, how much you might need, and the precipitation patterns expected, et cetera. Types of crops also play a key role.
When we talk about agricultural use, I would, as I think about that, we think of not just irrigation, but food production. And that's, as I understand, a huge use of water. Am I correct about that?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure what you mean by food production in this context.
Well, processing, maybe, rather than growing. The processing and the balance of making sure that a lot of our processors are in some of the areas where we have water stresses. And that's another issue that we all need to discuss as a community, because when you're talking about allocation, it's just not irrigation, it's processing too that is a priority, actually. So, and we have processors in some of our stressed areas in Southwest, and I think that's a big food processing area. Am I correct? Right. Yes,
Madam Chair,
I know that's true.
I don't have specific knowledge about food processing, and I don't have an answer for you on that.
Actually, well, we have looked at the food processing areas in the state, and there are 11 counties, and there are three, Nobles and Watonwan and Lyon, I think, in that area that are big food processing areas. Representative Anderson.
Ma'am, just one follow-up. We're talking about, Madam Chairman, sorry, talking about the older permits and things like that and the gallons of water. But isn't it also true that over the past number of years with the technologies of low-pressure pumps, different nozzles, and not pumping when it's 95 degrees and windy, that it's become much more of an efficient use of water?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, that's my understanding as well, and the technology on these irrigation systems is amazing. I attended an ag irrigation workshop a year ago, and they showed us that they can set up these systems to apply water at 160 different rates across a central pivot, meaning different zones depending on the soil. It's really remarkable, and the technology has come a long ways. One of the things that they do rely on is good climate information and good soil moisture information so that they can set these things to operate in the most efficient manner. And we're moving in that direction, clearly, as a state, certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to circle now back around to kind of where we started here, and that's the non-permitted wells. Do you have an estimate of how many of these non-permitted wells that are using significant amounts of water are out there, and what percentage of the total wells?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, I do not have that estimate with me. Or do I know of one exactly other than what Mr. Sweeney has referenced?
Mr. Sweeney, would you try to answer that question?
The representations that I've heard from the DNR.
The DNR is sitting right next to you, by the way, Mr. Sweeney.
I understand that.
We're a big agency.
Is that their estimate, and I think it's partly based on long-term experience, but more explicitly on these two recent efforts to really work on this issue, is that they thought about 10% of the irrigation wells that should be permitted were not, in these two areas at least.
And what was your, in your study, that was not what you determined? You determined that it was appeared to be greater.
Our analysis, our review, indicated that it certainly could be greater, and ours was not limited just to irrigation wells. But we were not able to prove that these were wells that should be permitted. But it's as I said, it was circumstantial evidence that there is perhaps a significant number of wells out there that should have well owners, rather than wells, well owners that should have groundwater appropriation permits that do not have them.
And so one of the consequences, I believe you said, is that then when DNR is permitting a well, a neighbor's well, they will not have the information about that well that is drawing down, or maybe two or three that are drawing down DNR doesn't know about because they're not permitted, and then what happens to this neighbor? I mean, this is, it's...
Madam Chair, once the DNR gets that appropriation, issues that appropriation permit, then they're able to insist on reporting of use.
Yes. That's the point I was trying to get to. So we, DNR is one of the shortfalls of not having everyone permitted, is DNR doesn't know about water use in some areas. Is that fair to say?
Madam Chair, members, the point being that there are wells that are not permitted, and therefore we do not know how much water they're using. And in some places, that's going to be more problematic than in others. I can tell you that in the one of the areas where we've had a very recent focus in the Bonanza Valley, we've dedicated a considerable amount of staff time to actually looking at aerial photos, going out and visiting places to see, well, it looks like there's an irrigation system here, but gee, we do not have a permit on file. So doing, you know, what Mr. Sweeney said you weren't able to do, and that's taken considerable amount of effort. And we've identified a number of folks, and they've been receiving letters from us over the last couple of weeks saying, gee, it looks like you have a well here, and you probably need a permit. Looks like you need a permit. And we're starting to get some responses back from folks saying, oh, I didn't realize that, and applying for some permits. So we're in the process. That's just one part of the state. So I can't, I mean, other than the about 10%, it's probably a reasonable guess statewide.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it seems to me the direct evidence of this would be problem, people with problem wells that are, you know, they're well, as you mentioned earlier, wells that are directly affected by overuse. And it seems, if I recall correctly, the number of those is very small. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, the number this year is, I think, around a dozen, somewhere in that neighborhood, of well interference complaints. One thing I would add is that our experience is that many people do not know that when their well goes dry, that they might actually have some recourse, that it could be somebody nearby that's pumping a high volume of water. And I can't cite specific examples, but I know that my staff hear about these situations. So in some cases, as you say, that would be an indication of some overuse in an area, or at least an impact from a use. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the well is, or that the aquifer is being unsustainably used. It just means that that particular well is being impacted, and it could be for a variety of reasons. It could be that it was a shallow well, you know, a whole host of those. I think if we were to rely on well interference complaints, we would be chasing the problem at the very end of the pipe rather than at the upstream end. It's more about getting the information on the front end to help us to do our job rather than try to put out the fires.
Thank you. Just one other topic that I'd like to check into very briefly would be the issue of test wells or monitoring wells. I know that there's generally a lack, but let's take this Bonanza area, for instance, that we've been talking about. Do you have monitoring wells in that area?
Madam Chair and Representative Thorkelson, yes, we do. And we've been recently adding some more to try to fill in some information gaps. We're also monitoring stream flows and lake and wetland levels to try to get a better handle on this whole system and how pumping in this area may or may not be affecting various streams, wetlands, and lakes in the Bonanza Valley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it seems to me that the state already knows about all the wells that have been drilled and what size they are. And if you have monitoring wells in the area to monitor the aquifer, I'm not saying people shouldn't permit their wells. They should, and they should, you know, obey the rules and regulations that are in place. But the state already has a significant amount of information regarding wells, and if there are test wells, you also have a way of monitoring the aquifer. Don't we know quite a bit about what's going on already?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, we are vastly under-equipped with monitoring wells. We have an average of one monitoring well for every 88 square miles of the state. It's really insufficient to determine whether or not in a location like Bonanza Valley, if the aquifers, and as many as there are, the geology of that area is very complex. There are buried valleys. There are buried small aquifers. It's not just a simple single aquifer system. So we don't have enough information to be able to conclusively make those determinations, as you said, even in a place like Bonanza Valley, which has now got more wells than many other places do. The same thing is true for the other area. I think was mentioned the Park Rapids area. We've been getting more wells up there because of the intensity of pumping, but we still don't have all the answers to the questions. It's very complex geology that these glaciers have left us in trying to piece those puzzles together. I think when we testified back in January here about groundwater, we relayed the statistic that we have 800 water level monitoring wells that we have in our network of wells that we use, that we check and work with local units of government, SWCDs, to get that information. We've estimated we need as many as 7,000 wells to do the job adequately. So we've got a ways to go. But we've been prioritizing the placement of new wells in the places where we think we have the biggest issues to try to grapple with.
Let me just remind me. My recollection is that Candio High County, which is part of Bonanza Valley, or does not have a geologic atlas at this point.
Madam Chair, I don't recall off the top of my head. That sounds correct, but I don't have the map in front of me to keep track. We've 19 completed and 17 underway, so I don't have them all in my head.
I believe that's the case, and that's one of the things that is our responsibility to deal with. I think the biggest question that I have in all of this, all the work that has to be done, and your budget don't match. And they don't match big time. So we are asking of you work on behalf of citizens who have wells and have drinking water to tell them what they can do, and you don't have the capacity to do it. That is my read of the situation. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. We don't feel like we have anywhere near the resources that we need to do the job. I would point out that, as Mr. Sweeney said, the Clean Water Legacy Funds have helped tremendously. We are making progress. The funding for the Atlas program is about to double if things go through as they have been recommended. We've significantly increased the amount of streams that are being measured, the flows, as part of TMDLs, but that information is valuable for evaluating groundwater flow as well. We're making progress. But as you've said, there's still a lot of information that we still need to get.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, let's talk about what we do have. You say there are a limited number of test wells and Bonanza Valley again. So what do those test wells show you coming off an extremely dry year? What are the water tables in those wells that you do have? What's it telling us?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I can't tell you what they all say. And certainly in some parts of the state, we do not see a declining trend in water levels. What we typically do see is that during the summer months, most of our monitoring wells will show a pumping signature. They go down. And then during the winter, they do come back up. In our testimony in January, I think I showed you a graphic for one of the longest records that we have in the state of Minnesota, which is in Orno, Minnetonka Boat Works. That graph is doing nothing but going down. That's the Prairie du Chien Jordan. It's clearly going down. There's no question about that. And it has a seasonal summertime pumping signature as well. The complicating factor in a place like Bonanza Valley or Straight River is that as the seasonal water levels go down, those aquifers are connected to lakes, streams, and wetlands. And if the aquifer is going down seasonally, that also can influence the amount of surface water that's expressed in a trout stream or a lake or a wetland, and those are some of the scenarios that we're evaluating. But I can't give you an overall across the state. We do know that in parts of the Twin Cities, we are on a downward trend. Some examples I've given you. In some parts of the Twin Cities, we're not. Down in Savage, the efforts to change the water supply down there to a quarry system has reversed that downward trend that had been present there for a number of years. Some parts of the state, we're not seeing any real clear trend. But we lack very long records in most cases. If I were to show you a graphic of the 60-year trend that I mentioned for Orono, and if I were to block out 50 years of that and just show you 10 years, and we did this at the Clean Water Council, if I show you just 10 years, it's really hard to say, gee, there's a trend. But when you look at it over the 60-year time frame, it's very clear that it's a downward trend. And the point I'm simply making is that aquifers respond sometimes quickly, sometimes very slowly. The bedrock aquifers in the Twin Cities, we're dealing with water that's as old as 30,000 years. We can't expect to see a direct pumping signature all the time and be able to draw those inferences immediately to what has taken place. We need the long-term record to really, truly evaluate some of these sustainability issues. Sometimes we don't. In some cases, it's very clear and we can see it. But more often than not, we need a longer-term record.
Representative Anderson.
Just a final comment. Talking about the surface water, then, all of our sloughs, right where I live, nobody irrigates around me at all. All of our potholes and sloughs went dry last summer. That's the drought that's doing that, not necessarily pumping from underground. So the environment has a lot to do also with our surface water levels anyway.
It's also not recharging when it's dry like that, which is one of the issues that I think we're just beginning to understand. I'm certainly just beginning to understand groundwater and its complexities in Minnesota and how much different geology we have. And I don't know about any of the rest of you, but I think my farmland would not be nearly as valuable as it is if I didn't have a good well. It's a very deep well, so then I start to think, So as people are losing water in some of our farmland areas, they're losing value of their land, which is not good. So with that, I don't see any other questions or for you all. Thank you so much for both of you for coming and helping us understand this. Appreciate it. And we are going to now ask for Michael Schmidt from Center for Environmental Advocacy to come up.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for doing this. I think this is as Oh, he's not here. Okay. So I have this sense, I don't know whether you guys do or not, but I have a sense that water issues are some of the most touchy issues we have to deal with. And I, it's not, I wouldn't liken it to the abortion issue, but I'm feeling about that, it's about that touchy. So with that, acknowledging that we have water issues in Minnesota, I invited people who are users to comment, and I would ask any of them, the big users, League of Cities, would you like to comment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I very much appreciate the invitation both yesterday morning and now. Really didn't have a specific list of things to raise. Happy to try and answer questions if I can.
Well, I can tell you as somebody from the metro area, and we see declines in the aquifers in the metro area and what's happening in the metro area, as I can speak to the metro area, is not sustainable. Are you just wanting us to ignore that, or do you have something valuable to contribute to problem solving?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's an easy question to answer. No, we don't expect to ignore it, and in fact our cities work very, very hard every day to address it. We have summer water use plans, emergency water use plans. We negotiate appropriations limits on our pumping with the state agencies. We renew those permits. We work very hard to implement water conservation measures, water conservation rates where they're appropriate, best management practices. We're required by law now and under the new stormwater permits that will soon be coming out to drastically increase infiltration of stormwater in every city that has a stormwater permit in the state. So we're literally spending billions of dollars to limit water use, improve water conservation rates. The amount of water use reduction that has happened from implementation of low flow plumbing equipment in new development, all of those things, has made a tremendous difference. And we have many water utilities that could come in and tell you the stories of what's happened with their utilities over the last 10 years. We had a number of those come in last year from the St. Cloud area, describe what their best management practices in that area had managed to achieve. And I think that's happening around the state because our water utilities are very, very interested in having a sustainable and safe and affordable supply of water for their communities. And I can tell you I meet every quarter with the Water Utility Council, which is the kind of executive body of the American Water Works Association chapter in Minnesota. And they spend a significant chunk of their agenda every quarter discussing environmental issues, sustainability issues. All of the state agencies attend those meetings and provide their input and comments, Department of Health, PCA, DNR, and Met Council. So I think overall cities are working very hard. Do we have to do more in some places? Of course. But I think all water users are facing that reality that between the drought and between increasing demand in certain areas, there's going to have to be some different things done in some places.
That's a pretty fair understatement of the metro area where what we're doing is not sustainable. And it's crystal clear that it's not sustainable. So we can say we're working hard, but we haven't achieved the outcome that we need. So the question is, how do we achieve the outcome we need so that your children and my grandchildren have water in the metro area if they choose to live there? So we haven't heard an answer to that question, and I think that is the question before us. And if you don't have any more comments, that is fine, but I think it's time that folks in the metro look at the sustainability
projections and acknowledge the truth. It's time. No matter how hard we work, we have a much bigger problem than we have been willing to talk about with the small things that we've been doing. Any questions for... Thank you. Anyone else in the audience who would like to come down and do problem solving, which is what a good legislature should be able to do?
Thank you for the invitation, Madam Chair. Bruce Clavin, Minnesota Irrigators Association. I got a call from your administrator yesterday. We traded phone messages. I told you ahead of the committee, our president is the expert that you would want here. And with the snow, he blew out the cattle yard this morning and was feeding and just simply could not get here. I'm going to be weak on my ability to answer questions for you, so I'll tell you that up front. I did visit with him this afternoon about some of the points to make for the committee, because we did not want to ignore the invitation of coming before you on the issue. The unpermitted use, that's something that I was just learning about here a little bit. Certainly they don't support that. The members of our association get the permits. So if there's unpermitted users out there, they would say everybody should have a permit. Secondly, on the overuse, and this was in the NPR article, talked about the overuse, that's something that they would not support if there needs to be an amendment to the permit, and certainly that would be more the route to go than just overusing by 10s and 20s and 50 times, as the article indicated. The interference of the wells, that's something that's been brought up. I think there's a procedure you've heard about from the department on the interference. That process is there. The membership knows about that it's there, at least the members do. I don't know if the public always does, but certainly that's something that they're glad to have in place as a conflict resolution procedure. They don't blow that off or take it lightly. So that's something that I wanted to mention to the members. Fourth, monitoring wells. I've talked with Mr. Meyer over the years on monitoring wells. The industry supports monitoring well. It's a question of cost that you've already raised, but I wanted to make that point. They support that. I know there's a bill somewhere around here, and I'm forgetting who has it. It's $9.5 million for monitoring wells. I can remember that Senator Wieger has it on the Senate side. I can't remember the House side offhand, but they would support installation of more monitoring wells. They want the data as well. And then finally, maybe just a mention on use. There's a lot of discussion about profitability, perhaps, and $8 corn and all this kind of stuff. One of the things that people forget about irrigation is the uniformity in products. A lot of the irrigation is for vegetable crops, primarily potatoes, sweet corn, and some peas. There's some corn, of course. But one of the things is potatoes, and uniformity in potatoes is something that's very important when you bring it to a French fryer. In about 93, Representative Keogh, you probably remember this, back in 93, Frito-Lay pulled out of the Red River Valley. They didn't want the potatoes anymore. And one of their issues, and probably their biggest one at the time, was uniformity for the chipping. And irrigation provides that. In fact, the industry in the valley is almost non-existent now, the potato side. It's moved out to North Dakota in the area around Tappan, and it's almost all under irrigation center pivots. So it's left the valley, and it's out there. And the industry wants that. Same with your can of sweet corn. The way those kernels get uniform, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, is through irrigation. So I wanted to point that out to members, that there's some reasons sometimes why you'd want to do that, and product uniformity is one of them. Those are my prepared remarks. I know you met our chairman at the AgriGrowth lunch. He introduced himself. I told him that on your opening day, you had four issues, and groundwater was one of them. And so at the lunch, he met you, and certainly call on him. If there's a follow-up evening, he'd be happy to come in.
Thank you for participating, and I think we will have some more conversations about this as we the 9.5 million for test monitoring wells is still not enough to get us on what I would think we should be on as a 10-year plan to get the job done. It doesn't seem that we want to be on a 40-year plan. Because for some, that will mean their water might get used up, and we don't want that to happen to anybody. So there is no magic in the 9.5. I think the magic would come if it was somewhat higher and that we actually figured out a dollar that would get us on a 10-year plan.
but that is my opinion about that dollar amount. I don't know whether you have any sense of that or could ask your president about that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do not now. The point in raising it was to express support for the initiative because we would support the installation of more monitoring wells. They want the data, too. They don't want them to run dry.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, something that keeps running through my brain, and I realize there's a lot of different things that there are now, but the 1930s was terribly dry. I mean, I listened to my grandfathers talk about how bad it was. And certainly we don't plow anymore. We don't do certain practices we used to. But I wonder, do we have any data at all about what the water table was back then? Because obviously it's been up and down. And I realize some of it's population. But in the 30s, there was a farm on every... probably every corner of every section of land in my district, where now that's very rare. You can have many sections where there's nobody living. And of course, irrigation was not, it's really rare in my district. There's probably, five people that, I don't even think it's five people that irrigate in the valley in District 1B. But actually, I had a farmer tell me that he wouldn't have done it again if what he has now he wouldn't do again because wasn't productive on the sugar beet land. We do a lot of dry land farming. But my point is you know, is this cyclical also? Certainly, the metropolitan area was not as populated, and I get that, but. I just wondered do we have any data or anybody that would know that?
I don't know the answer to the question, and I don't know whether Mr. Meckel is shaking his head. No. When we heard the testimony from USGS, they let us know that they didn't know the recharge rates for the state, and I think that's the other factor in here. Since then, I have heard that the Met Council has made some estimates of recharge rates, which is one of the reasons I am concerned about the lack of sustainability in the metropolitan area, because we are not recharging to the extent we need to. We can ask around. I don't know the answer to that question. And we can ask. We're going to have DNR do some checking on that. Yes. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to share a perspective? I don't. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to add one final comment as we move forward with these issues. I think it is important, as Representative Keel has pointed out, that we kind of separate the drought-related issues from the overuse issues, and I think they are two separate issues, and we shouldn't bulk them together because that would not be appropriate. The drought, we trust, is a temporary thing, a cyclical thing, whereas the overuse of groundwater is a chronic problem.
I think I go back to Dr. Seeley's testimony to us when he was talking about this particular drought and telling us that we were going to be in these more severe times where we're going to get a lot of rain. It's not going to help us with the recharge as much as we expected. So we are in a different time than we were during the 30s because we have these weather events that are going to be different. And that's, as I think Dr. Seeley's perspective needs to be taken to heart here. That's one of the things we think about. So are there any other comments from anybody in the audience on all of the budget presentations that we had? So we've talked about groundwater, and I am more and more sensing it is one of the most sensitive issues we can talk about. What about the budget? Much less sensitive. Anybody like to comment on any of the... yes, you're welcome to come and comment.
Good evening, Madam Chairman. My name is Laurel Fedema, and I'm the Chief Community Engagement Officer at Second Harvest Heartland. And I just want to take a very brief few moments to provide some basic background information on a line item in the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's budget that has already been reviewed, I believe, yesterday. So my purpose in being here is simply to provide information about the milk appropriation line item for the representatives this evening. And a handout is being passed around. The Minnesota Legislature has appropriated to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture $1 million in the past biennium for 6 food banks in Minnesota to use to buy milk from Minnesota producers and pass that on to food shelves across the state to then get to hungry folks in Minnesota. Just a little bit about Second Harvest. We are the largest food bank in Minnesota and the Midwest and one of the largest in the country. We're a nonprofit based in Maplewood. We distribute, last year we distributed 76 million pounds of food in our service area, which covers 41 counties in southwest, central, and metro Minnesota. So I'm here today representing Second Harvest and the 5 other food banks across the state of Minnesota that use this milk appropriation. And again, I'm just wanting to share a little bit of information about why it's very important to us that that continue. The most vulnerable people served by food banks and food shelves, children and seniors, are those most in need of milk. We found that 40% of those served by food shelves in Minnesota are children. They rely on milk for healthy physical, intellectual growth and development, and we know that good nutrition's essential for learning. About 7% of our users across the state of food shelves are seniors, and milk can be essential for preventing bone density loss and osteoporosis. So providing a full range of nutritious food is important to us. It's definitely an ongoing challenge for us as food banks and food shelves. Milk is highly, highly requested at Second Harvest Heartland from all of our partner agencies because it's so nutritious, because families want it. It's a rich source of protein, vitamins, calcium, minerals. It's in very high demand. Fluid milk in Minnesota is rarely donated. We have some generous donors, but it really only covers about 2% of what the need is for our emergency food system. So neither food banks or food shelves have sufficient financial resources to purchase all the milk that is requested. This grant for that reason is very important to us. Even with this grant, we estimate that that this grant is meeting about 30% of the need for milk based on our food shelves requests. And it's very important, and it doesn't meet the whole need by any factor, just to give you a sense of the scope of need. So this appropriation provides significant financial relief. We need to fundraise vigorously for any gap, and we know that our clients that come to food shelves certainly cannot afford milk on a regular basis at retail. Just very briefly how the program works, because of Second Harvest Heartland size, the 5 other food banks have authorized us to act as their agent in dispersing these funds. So we have Channel 1 in Rochester, Northern Lakes in Duluth, North Central in Grand Rapids, North Country in Crookston, and Great Plains in Fargo, who serves 1 county in western Minnesota on the border. And then, of course, Second Harvest. So the grant money to purchase the milk is allocated on an allocation that we use that we all agree is very fair, based on population data and then overlaying unemployment and poverty rates based on that. It's an allocation used by our national member association, Feeding America. We use it for a number of things, including also Minnesota's TFAP allocations from the U.S. government. So that's how the $1 million is allocated. The milk is purchased under the grants. That is purchased must be acquired from Minnesota producers, milk producers, and based on low-cost bids, which we re-get every year. Second Harvest submits quarterly reports to the commissioner, and you can see in the handout, you know, we must include information on the expenditure of funds, the amount of milk purchased, and all the details there are fully disclosed. First, food banks submit invoices to us quarterly. for reimbursement, the other food banks do for reimbursement to then receive the grant money. So finally, what's the impact? In the most recent full grant year, we bought 206,323 gallons of milk through this very important program, about 3.3 million servings of milk. I think one of the big points to make is that we feel like we're really making these tax dollars work very hard. Food banks are extremely efficient in their purchasing power. We make every dollar count for all the food we buy. Based on a volume and our negotiated low rate bids, this is what we do. We have some great relationships in that regard. We can buy more milk and get more gallons to needy people than any food shelf could do on their own based on these volume discounts. So you can see the breakout by food bank as far as kind of how the servings and gallons were used over the past full grant year. So with that, I just wanted to reiterate that we're so appreciative in the last biennium of these dollars. We're appreciative of our Minnesota milk producers for partnering with us on this. And it's just very important to us that this continues, especially in a climate where food shelf visits are increasing
Thank
in Minnesota.
Representative Anderson has a question.
Yes.
Not a question, Madam Chair, just a comment. This is an outstanding program. It's been around ever since I've been here. And it's great for the people that get the milk. It's a good promotion for Minnesota milk. So I want to thank you, and I fully support this program. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you for staying and testifying. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to comment on the budget?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I don't see anybody else who would like to comment on the budget. And with that, we are adjourned.